opened the door. The green glow, brilliant even through the dark glasses, washed over him like corrupt sunlight. 6. At first, he could see nothing at all. The light was too bright. He knew it had been brighter than this on other occasions, but he had never been so close to it before. Close? God, he was in it. Someone standing just outside the open door looking for him now would hardly be able to see him. He slitted his eyes against that brilliant greenness and shuffled forward a step, then another step, then a third. His hands were held out in front of him like those of a groping blind man, which he was. Shit, he even had the dark glasses to prove it. The noise was louder. Slish, slish, slish. Off to the left. He turned in that direction, but didn't go any further. He was afraid to go any further, afraid of what he might touch. Now his eyes began to adjust. He saw dark shapes in the green. A bench. But no Tommyknockers at it. It had simply been shoved back against the wall, out of the way, and... My God! It is a washing machine! It really is! It was all right. One of the old-fashioned kind with wringer roller at the top, but it wasn't making that weird noise. It had also been pushed back against the wall. It was in the process of being modified somehow. Someone was working on it in the best Tommyknocker tradition, but it wasn't running now. Next to it was an Electrolux vacuum cleaner, one of the old long ones that ran on wheels, low to the ground like a mechanical dachshund. A chainsaw mounted on wheels. Stacks of smoke detectors from Radio Shack, most still in their boxes. A number of kerosene drums, also on wheels, with hoses attached to them, and things like arms. Arms, of course they are. They're robots, fucking robots in the making. And none of them looks exactly like the white dove of peace, does it, guard? And slish, slish, slish. Further left. The source of the glow was here. Guard heard a funny, hurt noise escape him. The breath he had been holding ran weakly out like air from a pricked balloon. The strength ran out of his legs in exactly the same way. He reached out blindly. His hand found the bench, and he did not sit but simply plopped down on it. He was unable to take his eyes from the left rear corner of the shed, where Ev Hillman, Ann Anderson, and Bobby's good old beagle Peter had somehow been hung up on posts in two old galvanized steel shower cabinets with their doors removed. They hung there, like slabs of beef on meat hooks. But they were alive, guard saw, somehow, some way, still alive. A thick black cord, which looked like a high-voltage line or a very big coaxial cable, ran out of the center of Ann Anderson's forehead. A similar cable ran out of the old man's right eye, and the entire top of the dog's skull had been peeled away. Dozens of smaller cords ran out of Peter's exposed and pulsing brain. Peter's eyes, free of cataracts, turned toward guard. He whined. Jesus! Oh, my Jesus! Oh, my Jesus Christ! He tried to get up from the bench. He couldn't. Portions of the old man's skull and Anne's skull had also been removed, he saw. The doors had been torn off the shower stalls, but they were still full of some clear liquid. It was being contained in the same way that tiny sun was contained in Bobby's water heater, he supposed. If he tried to get into one of those stalls, he would feel a tough springiness, plenty of give, but no access. Want to get in? I only want to get out. Then his mind returned to its former scripture. Jesus, dear Jesus, oh my Jesus, look at them. I don't want to look at them. No, but he couldn't tear his eyes away. The liquid was clear, but emerald green. It was moving, making that low, thick, sudsy sound. For all its clarity, Gardner thought that the liquid must be very gluey indeed, perhaps the consistency of dish detergent. How can they breathe in there? How can they be alive? Maybe they're not. Maybe it's only the movement of the liquid that makes you think they are. Maybe it's just an illusion. Please, Jesus, let it be an illusion. Peter, you heard him whine. Nope. Part of the illusion, that's all. He's hanging on a hook in a shower stall filled with the interstellar equivalent of Joy dish detergent. He couldn't whine in that. It would come out all soap bubbles. And you're just freaking out. That's what it is. Just a little visit from King Freakout. Except he wasn't just freaking, and he knew it. Just as he knew he hadn't heard Peter whine with his ears. That hurt, helpless whining sound had come from the same place the radio music came from, the center of his brain. Ann Anderson opened her eyes. "Get me out of here," she screamed. "Get me out of here. I'll leave her alone. Only I can't feel anything except when they make it hurt, make it hurt, make it hurt." Gardner tried again to get up. He was very faintly aware that he was making a sound, just some old sound. The sound he was making was probably a lot like the sound a woodchuck run over in the road might make, he thought. The greenish, moving liquid gave Sissy's face a gassy, ghastly corpse hue. The blue of her eyes had bleached out. Her tongue floated like some fleshy undersea plant. Her fingers, wrinkled and pruny, drifted. "I can't feel anything except when they make it hurt," Anne wailed. And he couldn't shut her voice out, couldn't stick his fingers in his ears to make it go away, because that voice was coming from inside his head. Slish, slish, slish. Copper tubing running into the tops of the shower stalls, making them look like a hilarious combination of Buck Rogers suspended animation chambers and Lil Abner moonshine stills. Peter's fur had fallen out in patches. His hindquarters appeared to be collapsing in on themselves. His legs moved through the liquid in long, lazy sweeps, as if in his dreams he was running away. "When they make it hurt." The old man opened his one eye. "The boy." This thought was utterly clear, unquestionable. Gardner found himself responding to it. "What boy?" The answer was immediate, startling for a moment, then unquestionable. "David. David Brown." That one eye stared at him, a ceaseless sapphire with emerald tints. "Save the boy." The boy. David. David Brown. Was he a part of this somehow? The boy they had hunted for so many exhausting hot days? Of course he was. Maybe not directly, but a part of it. "Where is he?" Gardner thought at the old man, who floated in his pale green solution. Slish, slish, slish. "Altair 4," the old man returned finally. "David's on Altair 4. Save him. And then kill us. This is... it's bad. Real bad. Can't die. I've tried. We all have. Even... bitch, bitch. Her. This is being in hell. Use the transformer to save David. Then pull the plugs, cut the wires, burn the place. Do you hear?" For the third time, Gardner tried to get up and fell bonelessly back onto the bench. He became aware that thick electrical cords were scattered all over the floor, and that brought back a ghostly memory of the band that had picked him up on the turnpike when he was coming back from New Hampshire. He puzzled at this, and then got the connection. The floor looked like a concert stage just before a rock group started to play. That or a big city TV studio. The cables snaked into a huge crate filled with circuit boards and a stack of VCRs. They were wired together. He looked for a DC current converter, saw none, and then thought, "Of course not, idiot. Batteries are DC." The cassette recorders had been plugged into a mix of home computers, Ataris, Apple IIs and IIIs, TRS-80s, Commodores, Blinking on and off on the one lit screen was the word, Program? Behind the modified computers were more circuit boards, hundreds of them. The whole thing was uttering a low, sleepy hum, a sound he associated with, use the transformer, big electrical equipment. Light spilled out of the crate and the computers placed haphazardly next to it in a green flood. But the light was not quite steady. It was cycling. The pulse of the light and its relation to the sudsing sounds coming from the shower cabinets was very clear. That's the center, he thought, with an invalid's weak excitement. That's the annex to the ship. They come in the shed to use that. It's a transformer, and they draw their power from there. Use the transformer to save David. Might as well ask me to fly Air Force One. Ask me something easy, Pop. If I could bring him back from wherever he was by reciting Mark Twain, Poe even, I'd take a shot. But that thing, it looks like an explosion in an electronics warehouse. But the boy. How old? 4? 5? And where in God's name had they put him? The sky was, literally, the limit. Save the boy. Use the transformer. There was, of course, not even any time to look closely at the damned mess. The others would be coming back. Still, he stared at the one lighted video terminal with hypnotic intensity. Program? What if I typed Altair 4 on the keyboard, he wondered, and saw there was no keyboard. At the same second, the letters on the screen changed. Altair 4, it now read. No! His mind screamed, full of intruder's guilt. No, Jesus, no! The letters rippled. No, Jesus, no! Sweating, Gardner thought, cancel, cancel. Cancel, cancel. These letters blinked on and off, on and off. Gardner stared at them, horrified. Then, program? He made an effort to shield his thoughts and tried again to get to his feet. This time he made it. Other wires came out of the transformer. These were thinner. There were, he counted, yes, 8 of them, ending in earplugs. Earplugs. Freeman Moss, the animal trainer leading mechanical elephants. Here were more earplugs. In a crazy way, it reminded him of a high school language lab. Are they learning another language in here? Yes. No. They're learning to become. The machine is teaching them. But where are the batteries? I don't see any. There should be 10 or 12 big old Delcos hooked up to that thing. Just a maintenance charge running through it. There should be... Stunned, he raised his eyes to the shower stalls again. He looked at the coaxial cable coming out of the woman's forehead, the old man's eye. He watched Peter's legs moving in those big, dreamy strides, and wondered just how Bobby had gotten the dog hairs on her dress. Had she been giving Peter the equivalent of an interstellar oil change? Had she perhaps been overcome by a simple human emotion? Love? Remorse? Guilt? Had she perhaps hugged her dog before filling that cabinet up with liquid again? There are the batteries. Organic Delcos and Everettis, you might say. They're sucking them dry. Sucking them like vampires. A new emotion crept through his fear and bewilderment and revulsion. It was fury, and Gardner welcomed it. They make it hurt. Make it hurt. Make it hurt. Her voice cut off abruptly. The dull hum of the transformer changed pitch, cycled down even lower. The light coming out of the crate faded a little. He thought she had fallen unconscious, thereby lowering the machine's total output by X number of... What? Volts? Dynes? Ohms? Who the fuck knew? End it, son. Save my grandson, and then end it. For a moment the old man's voice filled his head, perfectly clear and perfectly lucid. Then it was gone. The old man's eye slipped closed. The green light from the machine grew paler yet. They woke up when I came in, he thought feverishly. The anger still pounded and drilled at his mind. He spat out a tooth almost without realizing he had done so. Even Peter woke up a little. Now they've gone back to whatever state they were in before. Sleeping? No, not sleeping. Something else. Organic cold storage. Do batteries dream of electric sheep? He thought, and uttered a cracked cackle. He moved backward, away from the transformer. What exactly is it transforming? How? Why? Away from the shower stalls, the cables. His eyes turned toward the array of gadgets ranged against the far wall. The Ringer washer had something mounted on top of it, something that looked like the boomerang TV antennas you sometimes saw on the backs of big limos. Behind the washer and to its left was an old-fashioned treadle sewing machine with a glass funnel mounted on its side wheel, kerosene drums with hoses and steel arms. A butcher knife, he saw, had been welded to the end of one of those arms. Christ, what is all this? What is it for? A voice whispered, "Maybe it's protection guard, in case the Dallas police show up early. It's the Tommyknocker Yard Sale Army. Old washing machines with cellular antennas, Electrolux vacuums, chainsaws on wheels. Name it and claim it, baby." He felt his sanity tottering. His eyes were drawn relentlessly back to Peter. Peter, with most of his skull peeled away. Peter, with a bunch of wires plugged into what remained of his head. His brain looked like a pallid veal roast with a bunch of temperature probes stuck into it. Peter, with his legs racing dreamily through that liquid, as if running away. "Bobby," he thought in despair and fury. "How could you do it to Peter? Christ!" The people were bad, awful, but Peter was somehow worse. It was a curse piled on top of an obscenity. Peter, his legs loping and loping as if running away in his dreams. Batteries. Living batteries. He backed into something. There was a dull metallic thump. He turned around and saw another shower cabinet. Little blossoms of rust on its sides, its front door gone. Holes had been punched in the back. Wires had been threaded through these. They now hung limply down, large-bore steel plugs at their tips. "For you, guard," his brain yammered. "This plug's for you, like the beer commercials say. They'll open up the back of your skull, maybe short out your motor control centers first, so you can't move, and then they'll drill. Drill for the place where they get their power. This plug's for you, for all you do. All ready and waiting. Wow, neato, keeno." He snatched for his thoughts, which were tightening into a hysterical spiral, and brought them under control. Not for him. At least not originally. This had already been used. There was that faint smell, bland and sudsy. Streaks of dried gunk on the inner walls. The last traces of that thick green liquid. Looks like the Wizard of Oz's semen, he thought. Do you mean Bobby's got her sister floating in a big sperm bank? That weird cackle escaped him again. He pressed the heel of his hand against his mouth, pressed hard to stifle it. He looked down and saw a pair of tan shoes tossed beside the shower cabinet. He picked one up, saw splashes of dried blood on it. Bobby's. Her one pair of good shoes. Her going-out shoes. She was wearing them when she left for the funeral that day. The other shoe was also bloody. Guard looked behind the shower cabinet and saw the rest of the clothing Bobby had been wearing that day. The blood. All that blood. He didn't want to touch the blouse, but the shape under it was too clear. He pinched as small a piece of it as he could between his fingers and peeled it up from Bobby's good charcoal-colored skirt. Underneath the skirt was a gun. It was the biggest, oldest-looking gun Gardner had ever seen except for pictures in a book. After a moment, he picked the gun up and rolled the cylinder. There were still four rounds in it, two gone. Gardner was willing to bet that one of those rounds had gone into Bobby. He pushed the cylinder back into place and stuck it in his belt. At once a voice spoke up in his mind. "Shot your wife. Good fucking deal. Never mind. The gun might come in handy."
"When they see it's gone, it's you they'll come looking for, guard. I thought you already came to that conclusion."
No, that was one thing he didn't think he had to worry about. They would have noticed the changed words on the computer screen, but these clothes hadn't been touched since Bobby took them off, or since they took them off her, which was probably more likely. "They must be too exalted when they get in here to bother much about housekeeping," he thought. "Damn good thing there's no flies." He touched the gun again. This time the voice in his head was silent. It had decided, perhaps, that there were no wives here to worry about.
"If you have to shoot, Bobby, will you be able to?"
That was a question he couldn't answer.
Slish, slish, slish.
How long had Bobby and her company been gone? He didn't know, hadn't the slightest idea. Time had no meaning in here. The old man was right. This was hell. And did Peter still respond to his strange master's caress when she came in here? His stomach was on the edge of revolt. He had to get out right now. He felt like a creature in a fairy tale. Bluebeard's wife in the secret room. Jack grubbing in the giant's pile of gold. He felt ripe for discovery. But he held the stiff, bloody garment in front of him as if frozen. Not as if. He was frozen.
"Where's Bobby?"
"She had a sunstroke."
Hell of a strange sunstroke that had soaked her blouse with blood.
Gardner had retained a morbid, sickish interest in guns and the damage they could do to the human body. If she had been shot with the big old gun now in his own belt, he guessed Bobby had no right to be alive. Even if she had been taken quickly to a hospital which specialized in the emergency treatment of gunshot wounds, she probably would have died.
"They brought me in here when I was blown apart, but the Tommyknockers fixed me up right smart."
Not for him. The old shower stall was not for him. Gardner had a feeling that he would be put out of the way with more finality. The shower stall had been for Bobby. They had brought her in here and...
what?
Why, hooked her up to their batteries, of course. Not Anne. She had not been here then. But to Peter and Hillman. He dropped the blouse, then forced himself to pick it up again and put it back on top of the skirt. He didn't know how much of the real world they noticed when they got in here. Not much, he guessed, but he didn't want to take any extra chances. He looked at the holes in the back of the cabinet, the dangling cords with the steel plugs at their tips. The green light had begun to pulse brighter and more rapidly again. He turned around. Anne's eyes were open again. Her short hair floated around her head. He could still see that unending hate in her eyes, now mixed with horror and growing strangeness. Now there were bubbles. They floated up from her mouth in a brief, thick stream. Thought sound exploded in his head. She was screaming. Gardner fled. 7. Real terror is the most physically debilitating of all emotions. It saps the endocrines, dumps muscle-tightening organic drugs into the bloodstream, races the heart, exhausts the mind. Jim Gardner staggered away from Bobby Anderson's shed on rubber legs, his eyes bugging, his mouth hanging stupidly open, the tongue lolled in one corner like a dead thing, his bowels hot and full, his stomach cramped. It was hard to think beyond the crude, powerful images which stuttered on and off in his mind like barroom neon. Those bodies, hung up on hooks, like bugs impaled on pins by cruel, bored children. Peter's relentlessly moving legs. The bloody blouse with the bullet hole in it. The plugs. The old-fashioned washing machine topped with the boomerang antenna. Strongest of all was the image of that short, thick stream of bubbles emerging from Anne Anderson's mouth as she screamed inside his head. He got into the house, rushed into the bathroom, and knelt in front of the toilet bowl, only to discover he couldn't puke. He wanted to puke. He thought of maggoty hot dogs, moldy pizza, pink lemonade with hairballs floating in it,
Finally, he rammed two fingers down his throat. He was able to trip a simple gag reaction by this last, but no more. He couldn't sick it up. Simple as that. If I can't, I'll go crazy. Fine, go crazy if you have to, but first do what you have to do. Keep it together that long. And just by the way, guard, do you have any more questions about what you should do? Not any more, he didn't. Peter's relentlessly moving legs had convinced him. That stream of bubbles had convinced him. He wondered how he could have hesitated so long in the face of a power that was so obviously corrupting, so obviously dark. "Because you were mad," he answered himself. Guard nodded. That was it. No more explanation was needed. He had been mad. And not just for the last month or so. It was late to wake up. Oh, yes, very late. But late was better than never. The sound. Slish, slish, slish. The smell. Bland, yet meaty. A smell his mind insisted on associating with raw veal slowly spoiling in milk. His stomach lurched. A burning, acidic burp scorched his throat. Gardner moaned. The idea, that glimmer, returned to him, and he clutched at it. It might be possible, either to abort all of this, or at least to put it on hold for a long, long time. It just might. You got to let the world go to hell in its own way, guard. 2 minutes to midnight or not. He thought of Ted, the power man, again. Thought of mad military organizations trading ever more sophisticated weapons with each other. And that angry, inarticulate, obsessed part of his mind tried to shout down sanity one final time. Shut up, Gardner told it. He went into the guest bedroom and pulled off his shirt. He looked out the window, and now he could see sparks of light coming out of the woods. Dark had come. They were returning. They would go into the shed and maybe have a little seance, a meeting of minds around the shower cabinets, fellowship in the homey green glow of raped minds. Enjoy it, Gardner thought. He put the .45 under the foot of the mattress, then unbuckled his belt. It may be the last time, so... He looked down at his shirt. Sticking out of the pocket was a bow of metal. It was the padlock, of course, the padlock which belonged on the shed door. 8. For a moment, which probably seemed much longer than it actually was, Gardner was unable to move at all. That feeling of unreal fairy tale terror stole back into his tired heart. He was reduced to a horrified spectator watching those lights move steadily along the path. Soon they would reach the overgrown garden. They would cut through. They would cross the dooryard. They would reach the shed. They would see the missing padlock. Then they would come into the house and either kill Jim Gardner or send his discorporated atoms to Altair 4, wherever that was. His first coherent thought was simple panic, yelling at the top of his voice, "Run! Get out of here!" His second thought was the shaky resurfacing of reason. Guard your thoughts. If you ever guarded them before, guard them now. He stood with his shirt off, his unbuckled and unzipped jeans sagging around his hips, staring at the padlock in his shirt pocket. Get out there right now and put it back. Right now! No, no time. Christ, there's no time. They're at the garden. There might be. There might be just enough if you quit playing pocket pool and get moving. He broke the paralysis with a final harsh effort of will, bent, snatched up the lock with the key still sticking out of the bottom, and ran, zipping his pants as he went. He slipped out the back door, paused for just a moment as the last two flashlights slipped into the garden and disappeared, then ran for the shed. Faintly, vaguely, he could hear their voices in his mind, full of awe, wonder, jubilation. He closed them out. Green light fanning out from the shed door, which stood ajar. Christ, guard, how could you have been so stupid? His cornered mind raved. But he knew how. It was easy to forget such mundane things as relocking doors when you had seen a couple of people hung up on posts with coaxial cables coming out of their heads. He could hear them in the garden now, could hear the rustle of the useless giant cornstalks. As he reached toward the hasp, lock in hand, he remembered closing it before dropping it into his pocket. His hand jerked at the thought, and he dropped the goddamn thing. It thumped to the ground. He looked for it, and at first couldn't see it at all. No, there it was. There, just beyond the narrow fan of pulsing green light. There was the lock, yes. But the key wasn't in it anymore. The key had fallen out when the lock thumped to the ground. God, my God, my God, his mind sobbed. His body was now covered with oozing sweat. His hair hung in his eyes. He thought he must smell like a rancid monkey. He could hear cornstalks and leaves rustling louder. Someone laughed quietly. The sound was shockingly near. They would be out of the garden in seconds. He could feel those seconds bustling by like self-important businessmen with pot bellies and attaché cases. He went down on his knees, snatched up the lock, and began to sweep his hand back and forth in the dirt, trying to find the key. Oh, you bastard, where are you? Oh, you bastard, where are you? Oh, you bastard, where are you? Aware that even now, in his panic, he had thrown a screen around his thoughts. Was it working? He didn't know. And if he couldn't find the key, it didn't matter, did it? Oh, you bastard, where are you? He saw a dull glint of silver beyond where he was sweeping his hand. The key had gone much further than he would have believed. His seeing it was only dumb luck. Like Bobby, stumbling over that little rim of protruding metal in the earth 2 months before, he supposed. Gardner snatched it and bolted to his feet. He would be hidden from them by the angle of the house for just a moment longer, but that was all he had left. One more screw-up, even a little one, would finish him, and there might not be enough time left even if he performed each of the mundane little operations involved in padlocking a door perfectly. The fate of the world may now depend on whether a man can lock a shed door on the first try, he thought dazedly. Modern life is so challenging. For a moment he didn't think he was even going to be able to slot the key in the lock. It chattered all the way around the slit without going in, a prisoner of his shaking hand. Then, when he thought it really was all over, it slid home. He turned it, the lock opened. He closed the door, slipped the arm of the padlock through the hasp, and then clicked it shut. He pulled the key out and folded it into his sweating hand. He slid around the corner of the shed like oil. At the exact moment he did, the men and women who had gone out to the ship emerged into the dooryard, moving in single file. Gardner reached up to hang the key on the nail where he had found it. For one nightmare moment he thought he was going to drop it again and have to hunt for it in the high weeds growing on this side of the shed. When it slipped onto the nail, he let out his breath in a shuddering sigh. Part of him wanted not to move, to just freeze here. Then he decided he'd better not take the risk. After all, he didn't know that Bobby had her key. He continued slipping along the side of the shed. His left ankle struck the haft of an old harrow that had been left to rust in the weeds, and he had to clamp his teeth over a cry of pain. He stepped over it and slipped around another corner. Now he was behind the shed. That sudsing sound was maddeningly loud back here. I'm right behind those goddamn showers, he thought. They're floating inches from me. Literally inches. A rustle of weeds. A minute scrape of metal. Gardner felt simultaneously like laughing and screeching. They hadn't had Bobby's key. Someone had just come around to the side of the shed and taken the key Gardner had hung up again only seconds before. Probably Bobby herself. Still warm from my hand, Bobby, did you notice? He stood in back of the shed, pressed against the rough wood, arms slightly spread, palms tight on the boards. Did you notice? And do you hear me? Do any of you hear me? Is someone, Allison or Archimborg or Beringer, going to suddenly pop his head around here and yell out, "Peekaboo, guard, we see you." Is the shield still working? He stood there and waited for them to take him. They didn't. On an ordinary summer night, he probably would not have been able to hear the metallic rattle as the door was unlocked. It would have been masked by the loud re, re, re of the crickets. But now there were no crickets. He heard the unlocking, heard the creak of the hinges as the door was opened, heard the hinges creak again as the door was pushed shut. They were inside. Almost at once the pulses of light falling through the cracks began to speed up and become brighter, and his mind was split by an agonized scream.
"Hurts! It hurts!"
He moved away from the shed and went back to the house. 9. He lay awake a long time, waiting for them to come out again, waiting to see if he had been discovered. "All right, I can try to put a stop to the becoming," he thought, "but it won't work unless I actually can go inside the ship. Can I do that?" He didn't know. Bobby seemed to have no worries, but Bobby and the others were different now. Oh, he himself was also becoming. The lost teeth proved that. The ability to hear thoughts did, too. He had changed the words on the computer screen just by thinking them. But there was no use kidding himself. He was far behind the competition. If Bobby survived the entry into the ship and her old buddy guard dropped dead, would any of them, even Bobby herself, spare a tear? He didn't think so. Maybe that's what they all want, Bobby included. For you to go into the ship and just fall over with your brains exploding in one big harmonic radio transmission. It would save Bobby the moral pain of taking care of you herself, for one thing. Murder without tears. That they intended to get rid of him, he no longer doubted. But he thought that maybe Bobby, the old Bobby, would let him live long enough to see the interior of the strange thing they had worked so long to dig up. That, at least, felt right. And in the end, it didn't matter. If murder was what Bobby was planning, there was no real defense, was there? He had to go into the ship. Unless he did that, his idea, crazy as it undoubtedly was, had no chance to work at all. Have to try, guard. He had intended to try as soon as they were inside, and that would probably be tomorrow morning. Now he thought that maybe he ought to press his luck a little further. If he went according to the rag and a bone he supposed he had to call his original plan, there would be no way he could do anything about that little boy. The kid would have to come first. Guard, he's probably dead anyway. Maybe. But the old man didn't think so. The old man thought there was still a little boy left to save. One kid doesn't matter. Not in the face of all this. You know it, too. Haven is like a great big nuclear reactor that's ready to go redline. The containment is melting, to coin a phrase. It was logical, but it was Croupier's logic. Ultimately, killer logic. Ted the Power Man logic. If he wanted to play the game that way, why even bother? The kid matters, or nothing matters. And maybe this way he could even save Bobby. He didn't think so. He thought Bobby had gone too far for salvation. But he could try. Long odds, guard, old guard. Sure. The clock said a minute to midnight. We're down to counting seconds. Thinking that, he slipped into the blankness of sleep. This was followed by nightmares, where he floated in a clear green bath, tethered by thick coaxial cables. He was trying to scream, but he couldn't, because the cables were coming out of his mouth. Chapter 5. The Scoop. 1. Entombed in the over-decorated confines of the Bounty Tavern, drinking buck-a-bottle Heinekens and laughed at by David Bright, who had sunk to vulgar depths of humor, who had even ended up comparing John Leandro to Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, Leandro had wavered. No use telling himself otherwise. He had, indeed, wavered. But men of vision have always had to endure barbs of ridicule, and not a few have been burned or crucified or had their height artificially extended by 5 or 6 inches on the inquisitorial rack of pain for their visions. Having David Bright ask him over beers in the Bounty if his secret wristwatch was in good working order was hardly the worst thing that could have befallen him. But, oh, shit.
It hurt. John Leandro determined that David Bright, and anyone else to whom Bright had related Crazy Johnny's ideas that something big was going on in Haven, would end up laughing on the other side of his or her face. Because something big was going on there. He felt it in every bone in his body. There were days when the wind was blowing from the southeast that he almost imagined he could smell it. His vacation had begun the previous Friday. He had hoped to go down to Haven that very day, but he lived with his widowed mother, and she had been counting so on him running her up to Nova Scotia to see her sister, she said. But if John had commitments, why, she understood. After all, she was old and probably not much fun anymore. Just someone to cook his meals and wash his underwear, and that was fine. You go on, Johnny, go on and hunt up your scoop. I'll just call Megan on the telephone. Maybe in a week or two your cousin Alfie will bring her down to see me. Alfie's so good to his mother, etc., etc., ibid, ibid, ad infinitum. On Friday, Leandro took his mother to Nova Scotia. Of course, they stayed over, and by the time they got back to Bangor, Saturday was shot. Sunday was a bad day to begin anything, what with his Sunday school class of first and second graders at 9, full worship services at 10, and Young Men for Christ in the Methodist Rectory at 5 p.m. At the YMC meeting, a special speaker gave them a slideshow on Armageddon, as he explained to them how unrepenting sinners would be inflicted with boils and running sores and ailments of the bowels and the intestines. Georgina Leandro and the other members of the Ladies' Aid passed out paper cups of Xarex and oatmeal cookies. And during the evening, there was always a song fest for Christ in the church basement. Sundays always left him feeling exalted and exhausted. 2. So it was Monday, the 15th of August, before Leandro finally tossed his yellow legal pads, his Sony tape recorder, his Nikon, and a gadget bag filled with film and various lenses into the front seat of his used Dodge and prepared to set out for Haven, and what he hoped would be journalistic glory. He would not have been appalled if he had known he was approaching ground zero of what was shortly to become the biggest story since the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. The day was calm and blue and mellow, very warm, but not so savagely hot and humid as the last few days had been. It was a day everyone on earth would mark forever in his memory. Johnny Leandro had wanted a story, but he had never heard the old proverb that goes, "God says, take what you want, and pay for it." He only knew that he had stumbled onto the edge of something, and when he tried to wiggle it, it remained firm, which meant it was maybe bigger than one might at first think. There was no way he was going to walk away from this. He intended to excavate. All the David Brights in the world, with their smart cracks about Jimmy Olsen wristwatches and Fu Manchu, could not stop him. He put the Dodge in drive and began to roll away from the curb. "Don't forget your lunch, Johnny," his mother called. She came puffing down the walk with a brown paper sack in one hand. Large grease spots were already forming on the brown paper. Since grade school, Leandro's favorite sandwich had been bologna, slices of Bermuda onion, and Wesson oil. "Thanks, Mom," he said, leaning over to take the bag and put it down on the floor. "You didn't have to do that, though. I could have picked up a hamburger." "If I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, she said. "You have no business going into those roadside luncheonettes, Johnny. You never know if the kitchen's dirty or clean." "Microbes," she said ominously, leaning forward. "Ma, I gotta—" "You can't see microbes at all," Mrs. Leandro went on. She was not to be turned from her subject until she had had her say on it. "Yes, Mom," Leandro said, resigned. "Some of those places are just havens for microbes," she said. "The cooks may not be clean, you know. They may not wash their hands after leaving the lavatory. They may have dirt or even excrement under their nails. This isn't anything I want to discuss, you understand, but sometimes a mother has to instruct her son.
Food in places like that can make a person very, very sick.
Mom, she uttered a long-suffering laugh and dabbed momentarily at the corner of one eye with her apron.
Oh, I know. Your mother is silly, just a silly old woman with a lot of funny old ideas, and she probably ought to just learn to shut up.
Leandro recognized this for the manipulative trick it was, but it still always made him feel squirmy, guilty, about 8 years old.
No, Mom, he said, I don't think that at all. I mean, you are the big newsman. I just sit home and make your bed and wash your clothes and air out your bedroom if you get the farts from drinking too much beer.
Leandro bent his head, said nothing, and waited to be released. But do this for me. Stay out of roadside luncheonettes, Johnny, because you can get sick from microbes. I promise, Mom. Satisfied that she had extracted a promise from him, she was now willing to let him go.
You'll be home for supper?
Yes, Leandro said, not knowing any better.
At 6? She persisted.
Yes, yes.
I know, I'm just a silly old...
Bye, Mom, he said hastily and pulled away from the curb. He looked in the rearview mirror and saw her standing at the end of the walk, waving. He waved back, then dropped his hand, hoping she would go back into the house, and knowing better. When he made a right turn 2 blocks down and his mother was finally gone, Leandro felt a faint but unmistakable lightening of his heart. Rightly or wrongly, he always felt this way when his mom finally dropped out of sight. 3. In Haven, Bobby Anderson was showing Jim Gardner some modified breathing apparatus. Ev Hillman would have recognized it. The respirators looked very similar to the one he had picked up for the cop, Butch Dugan. But that one had been to protect Dugan from the Haven air. The respirators Bobby was demonstrating drew on reserves of just that. Haven air was what they were used to, and Haven air was what the two of them would breathe if they got inside the Tommyknocker's ship. It was 9:30. At that same time, in Derry, John Leandro had pulled over to the side of the road not far from the place where the gutted deer and the cruiser requisitioned to officers Rhodes and Gabbins had been found. He thumbed open the glove compartment to check on the Smith & Wesson 38 he had picked up in Bangor the week before. He took it out for a moment, not putting his forefinger anywhere near the trigger, even though he knew it was unloaded. He liked the compact way the gun fitted his palm, its weight, the feeling of simple power it somehow conveyed. But it also made him feel a trifle skittery, as if he might have torn off a chunk of something that was far too big for the likes of him to chew. A chunk of what? He wasn't quite sure. Some sort of strange meat.
Microbes, his mother's voice spoke up in his mind. Food in places like that can make a person very, very sick.
He checked to make sure the carton of bullets was still in the glove compartment, then put the gun back. He guessed that transporting a handgun in the glove compartment of a motor vehicle was probably against the law. He thought again of his mother, this time without even realizing he was doing so. He could imagine a cop pulling him over for something routine, asking to see his registration and getting a glimpse of the 38 when Leandro opened the glove compartment. That was the way murderers always got caught on Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which he and his mother watched every Saturday night on the cable station that showed it. It would also be a scoop of a different sort. Bangor Daily News reporter arrested on illegal weapons charge. Well then, take your registration out of the glove compartment and put it in your wallet if you're so worried. But he wouldn't do that. The idea made perfect sense, but it also seemed like buying trouble. And that voice of reason sounded altogether too much like the voice of his mother, warning him about microbes, or instructing him, as she had when he was a boy, on the horrors which might result if he forgot to put paper all over the ring of a public toilet before sitting on it. Leandro drove on instead, aware that his heart was beating a little too fast, and that he felt just a little sweatier than the heat of the day could explain. Something big. Some days I can almost smell it. Yes,
Something was out there, all right. The death of the McCausland woman. A furnace explosion in July. Oh, really? The disappearance of the investigating troopers. The suicide of the cop who had supposedly been in love with her. And before any of those things, there had been the disappearance of the little boy. David Bright had said David Brown's grandfather had been spouting a lot of crazy nonsense about telepathy and magic tricks that really worked. I only wish you'd come to me instead of Bright, Mr. Hillman, Leandro thought for perhaps the 50th time. Except now, Hillman had disappeared. Hadn't been back to his rooming house in over 2 weeks. Hadn't been back to Derry Home Hospital to visit his grandson, although the nurses had had to boot him out nights before. The official state police line was that Ev Hillman hadn't disappeared, but that was catch-22, because a legal adult couldn't disappear in the eyes of the law until another legal adult so reported that person, filling out the proper forms in consequence. So all was Jake in the eyes of the law. All was far from Jake in the eyes of John Leandro. Hillman's landlady told him that the old man had stiffed her for $60. As far as Leandro had been able to find out, it was the first unpaid bill the old guy had left in his life. Something big. Strange meat. Nor was that all of the weirdness emanating out of Haven these days. A fire, also in July, had killed a couple on the Nister Road. This month, a doctor piloting a small plane had crashed and burned. That had happened in Newport, true, but the FAA controller at BIA had confirmed that the unfortunate doc had overflown Haven, and at an illegally low altitude. Phone service in Haven had begun to get oddly glitchy. Sometimes people could get through, sometimes they couldn't. He had sent to the Augusta Bureau of Taxation for a list of Haven voters, paying the required fee of $6 to get the 9 computer sheets, and had managed to trace relatives of nearly 60 of these Havenites, relatives living in Bangor, Derry, and surrounding areas, in his spare time. He couldn't find one, not one, who had seen his or her Haven relations since July 10th or so, over a month before. Not one. Of course, a lot of those he interviewed didn't find this strange at all. Some of them weren't on good terms with their Haven relations, and couldn't care less if they didn't hear from or see them in the next 6 months or 6 years. Others seemed first surprised, then thoughtful, when Leandro pointed out the length of time they were talking about. Of course, summer was an active season for most people. Time passed with a light easiness that winter knew nothing about. And, of course, they had spoken to Aunt Mary or Brother Bill a time or two on the phone. Sometimes you couldn't get through, but mostly you could. There were other suspicious similarities in the testimony of the people Leandro interviewed, similarities that had made his nose flare with the smell of something decidedly off. Ricky Berenger was a house painter in Bangor. His older brother Newt was a carpenter contractor who also happened to be a Haven selectman. We invited Newt up for dinner near the end of July, Ricky said, but he said he had the flu. Don Blue was a dairy realtor. His Aunt Sylvia, who lived in Haven, had been in the habit of coming up to take dinner with Don and his wife every Sunday or so. The last 3 Sundays she had begged off. Once with the flu. Flu seems to be going around in Haven, Leandro thought. Nowhere else, you understand. Just in Haven. And the other times, because it was so hot, she just didn't feel like traveling. After further questioning, Blue realized it had been more like 5 Sundays since his aunt had favored them, and maybe as many as 6. Bill Spruce kept a herd of dairy cows in Cleves Mills. His brother Frank kept a herd in Haven. They usually got together every week or two, merging 2 extremely large families for a few hours. The clan Spruce would eat tons of barbecue, drink gallons of beer and Pepsi-Cola, and Frank and Bill would sit either at the picnic table in Frank's backyard or on the front porch of Bill's house, and compare notes about what they simply called the business. Bill admitted it had been a month or more since he'd seen Frank. There had been some problem, first with his feed supplier, Frank had told him, then with the milk inspectors. Bill, meanwhile, had had a few problems of his own. 6 of his Holsteins had died during this last hot spell.
And, he added as an afterthought, his wife had had a heart attack. He and his brother just hadn't had time to visit much this summer. But the man had still expressed unfeigned surprise when Leandro dragged out his wallet calendar and the two of them figured out just how long it had been. The two brothers hadn't gotten together since June 30th. Spruce whistled and tilted his cap back on his head. "Gary, that is a long time," he had said. "Guess I'll have to take a ride down Haven and see Frank, now that my Evelyn's on the mend." Leandro said nothing, but some of the other testimony he had gathered over the last couple of weeks made him think that Bill Spruce might find a trip like that hazardous to his health. "Felt like I was dying," Alvin Rutledge told Leandro. Rutledge was a long-haul trucker, currently unemployed, who lived in Bangor. His grandfather was Dave Rutledge, a lifelong Haven resident. "What exactly do you mean?" Leandro asked. Alvin Rutledge looked at the young reporter shrewdly. "Another beard go down good just about now," he said. They were sitting in Nan's Tavern in Bangor. "Talkin's amazing dusty work, chummy."
"Isn't it?" Leandro said, and told the waitress to draw two.
Rutledge took a deep swallow when it came, wiped foam from his upper lip with the heel of his hand, and said, "Heart beating too fast. Headache. Felt like I was going to puke my guts out. I did puke, as a matter of fact, just before I turned around. Rolled down the window and just let her fly into the slipstream, I did."
"Wow," Leandro said, since some remarks seemed called for.
The image of Rutledge letting her fly into the slipstream flapped in his mind. He dismissed it. At least he tried. "And look a-here." He rolled back his upper lip, revealing the remains of his teeth.
"Or see a hole in front?"
Rutledge asked. Leandro saw a good many holes in front, but thought it might not be politic to say so. He simply agreed. Rutledge nodded and let his lip fall back into place. It was something of a relief.
"Teeth never have been much good," Rutledge said indifferently. "When I get working again and can afford me a good set of dentures, I'm going to have all of them jerked. Fuck 'em. Point is, I had my two front teeth there on top before I headed up to Haven week before last to check on Gramp. Hell, they wasn't even loose."
"They fell out when you started to get close to Haven?"
"Didn't fall out," Rutledge finished his beer. "I puked them out."
"Oh," Leandro had replied faintly.
"You know, another brood go down good. Talkin's
thirsty work, I know," Leandro said, signaling the waitress. He was over his limit, but he found he could use another one himself.
4.
Alvin Rutledge wasn't the only person who had tried to visit a friend or relative in Haven during July, nor the only one to become ill and turn back. Using the voting lists and area phone books as a starting point, Leandro turned up three people who told stories similar to Rutledge's. He uncovered a fourth incident through pure coincidence, or almost pure. His mother knew he was following up some aspect of his big story and happened to mention that her friend Eileen Pulsifer had a friend who lived down in Haven. Eileen was 15 years older than Leandro's mother, which put her close to 70. Over tea and cloyingly sweet ginger snaps, she told Leandro a story similar to those he had already heard. Mrs. Pulsifer's friend was Mary Jacqueline, whose grandson was Tommy Jacqueline. They had visited back and forth for more than 40 years, and often played in local bridge tournaments. This summer she hadn't seen Mary at all, not even once. She'd spoken to her on the phone, and she seemed fine. Her excuses always sounded believable. But all the same, something about them—a bad headache, too much baking to do—the family had decided on the spur of the moment to go down to Kennebunk and visit the Trolley Museum. Wasn't quite right.
"They were fine by the one by one, but they seemed odd by the bunch, if you see what I mean."
She offered the cookies.
"More snaps?"
"No, thank you," Leandro said.
"Oh, go ahead. I know you boys. Your mother taught you to be polite, but no boy ever born could turn down a ginger snap. Now you just go on and take what you hanker for." Smiling dutifully, Leandro took another ginger snap. Settling back and folding her hands on her tight, round belly, Mrs. Pulsifer went on,
"I begun to think something might be wrong. I still think that maybe something's wrong, truth to tell. First thing to cross my mind was that maybe Mary didn't want to be my friend any more. Then maybe I did or said something to offend her. But no, says I to myself, if I'd done something, I guess she'd tell me. After 40 years of friendship, I guess she would. Besides, she didn't really sound cool to me, you know?
But she did sound different." Eileen Pulsifer nodded decisively.
"I am. And that got me thinking that maybe she was sick. That maybe, God save us, her doctor had found a cancer of something inside her, and she didn't want any of her old friends to know. So I called up Vera, and I said, 'We're going to go down to Haven, Vera, and see Mary. We ain't going to tell her we're coming, and that way she can't call us off. You get ready, Vera,' I says, 'because I'm coming by your house at 10 o'clock, and if you ain't ready, I'm going to go without you.' Vera is Vera Anderson in Derry. Just about my best friend in the whole world, John, except for Mary and your mother. And your mother was down in Monmouth, visiting her sister that week."
Leandro remembered it well. A week of such peace and quiet was a week to be treasured. "So the two of you headed down?"
"I am."
"And you got sick?"
"Sick? I thought I was dying. My heart."
She clapped a hand dramatically over one breast.
"It was beating so fast. My head started to ache. I got a nosebleed. And Vera got scared. She says, 'Turn around, Eileen, right now. You got to get to the hospital right away.' Well, I turned around somehow. I don't hardly remember how. The world was spinning so. And by then, my mouth was bleeding, and two of my teeth fell out. Right out of my head. You ever hear the beat of it?"
"No," he lied, thinking of Alvin Rutledge.
"Where did it happen?" "Why, I told you. We were going to see Mary Jacqueline."
"Yes. But were you actually in Haven when you got sick? And which way did you come in?"
"Oh, I see. No, we weren't. We were on Old Derry Road in Troy."
"Close to Haven, then?"
"Oh, about a mile from the town line. I'd been feeling sick for a little time, whoopsie, you know, but I didn't want to say so to Vera. I kept hoping that I would feel better."
Vera Anderson hadn't gotten sick, and this troubled Leandro. It didn't fit. Vera hadn't gotten a bloody nose, nor lost any teeth.
"No, she didn't get sick at all," Mrs. Pulsifer said, "except with Tara. I guess she was sick with that. For me, and for herself, too, I imagine."
"How do you mean?"
"Well, that road's awful empty. She thought I was going to pass out. I almost did. It might have been 15, 20 minutes before someone came along."
"She couldn't have driven you?"
"God bless you, John. Vera's had muscular dystrophy for years. She wears great big metal braces on her legs. Cruel-looking things they are. Like something you'd expect to see in a torture chamber. Just about makes me cry sometimes to see her."
5. At 9:45 on the morning of August 15th, Leandro crossed into the town of Troy. His stomach was tight with anticipation, and, let's face it, folks, a tingle of fear. His skin felt cold.
"I may get sick. I may get sick. And if I do, I'm going to leave about 90 feet of rubber reversing out of the area. Got that?"
"I got it, boss," he answered himself.
"I got it. I got it."
"You may lose some teeth, too," he cautioned himself. But the loss of a few teeth seemed a small price to pay for a story which might win him a Pulitzer Prize. And, just as important, one which would surely turn David Bright green with envy. He passed through Troy Village, where everything seemed fine, if a little slower than usual. The first jag in the normal run of things came about a mile further south, from a direction he wouldn't have expected. He had been listening to WZON out of Bangor. Now the normally strong AM signal began to waver and flutter. Leandro could hear one, no two, no,
three other stations mixed in with its signal. He frowned. That sometimes happened at night, when radiant cooling thinned the atmosphere and allowed radio signals to travel further. But he had never heard of it happening on an AM bank in the morning, not even during those periods of optimum radio transmission conditions which ham operators call the skip. He ran the tuner on the Dodge's radio and was amazed as a flood of conflicting transmissions poured out of the speakers. Rock and roll, country and western, and classical music stepped all over each other. Somewhere in the background he could hear Paul Harvey extolling Amway. He turned the dial further and caught a clear transmission so surprising he pulled over. He sat staring at the radio with big eyes. It was speaking in Japanese. He sat and waited for the inevitable clarification. "This lesson in beginner's Japanese has been brought to you by your local Kyanai's paint dealer," something like that. The announcer finished. Then came the Beach Boys' "Be True to Your School" in Japanese. Leandro continued to tune down the kilohertz band with a hand that shook. It was much the same all the way. As it did at night, the tangle of voices and music got worse as he tuned toward the higher frequencies. At last the tangle grew so severe it began to frighten him. It was the auditory equivalent of a squirming mass of snakes. He turned the radio off and sat behind the wheel, eyes wide, body thrumming slightly, like a man on low-grade speed. What is this? Foolish to speculate when the answer lay no more than 6 miles up ahead, always assuming he could uncover it, of course. Oh, I think you'll uncover it. You may not like it when you do, but, yeah, I think you'll uncover it with no trouble at all. Leandro looked around. The hay in the field on his right was long and shaggy. Too long and shaggy for August. There hadn't been any first cutting in early July. Somehow he didn't think there was going to be any August cutting either. He looked left and saw a tumble-down barn surrounded by rusty auto parts. The corpse of a 57 Studebaker was decaying in the barn's maw. The windows seemed to stare at Leandro. There were no people to stare, at least not that he could see. A very quiet, very polite little voice spoke up inside him, the voice of a child at a tea party that has become decidedly scary. "I would like to go home, please." "Yes, home to Mother. Home in time to watch the afternoon soaps with her. She would be glad to see him back with his scoop, maybe even more glad to see him back without it. They'd sit and eat cookies and drink coffee. They would talk. She would talk, rather, and he would listen. That was how it always was, and it really wasn't that bad. She could be an irritating thing sometimes, but she was...
safe.
Safe, yeah. That was it, safe. And whatever was going on south of Troy on this dozy summer afternoon, it wasn't at all safe.
"I would like to go home, please."
Right. There had probably been times when Woodward and Bernstein felt that way when Nixon's boys were really putting the squeeze on. Bernard Fall had probably felt that way when he got off the plane in Saigon for the last time. When you saw the TV news correspondents in trouble spots like Lebanon and Tehran, they only looked cool, calm, and collected. Viewers never had a chance to inspect their shorts. "The story is out there, and I'm going to get it. And when I collect my Pulitzer Prize, I can say I owe it all to David Bright and my secret Superman wristwatch." He put the Dodge in gear again and drove on toward Haven. 6. He hadn't gone a mile before he began to feel ill. He thought this must be a physical symptom of his fear, and ignored it. Then, when he began to feel worse, he asked himself, as one is apt to do when he realizes that the nausea sitting in his stomach, like a small dark cloud, is not going away, what he had eaten. There was no blame to be laid in that direction. He hadn't been afraid when he got up that morning, but he had been feeling a lot of anticipation and high-spirited tension. As a result, he had refused the usual bacon and scrambled eggs and settled for tea and dry toast. That was all.
"I would like to go home," the voice was now more shrill.
Leandro pushed on, teeth clamped grimly together. The scoop was in Haven. If he couldn't get into Haven, there would be no scoop. You couldn't hit him if you couldn't see him. QED. Less than a mile from the town line, the day was eerily, utterly dead. A series of beeping, booping, and buzzing noises began to come from the back seat, startling him so badly that he cried out and pulled over to the side of the road again. He looked in back and was at first unable to credit what he was seeing. It had to be, he thought, a hallucination brought on by his increasing nausea. When he and his mother had been in Halifax this past weekend, he had taken his nephew Tony out for a Dairy Queen. Tony, whom Leandro privately thought was an ill-mannered little snot, had sat in the back playing with a plastic toy that looked a bit like the handset of a prince's phone. This toy was called Merlin, and it ran on a computer chip. It played four or five simple games, which called for simple feats of memory or the ability to identify a simple mathematical series. Leandro remembered it had also played tic-tac-toe. Anyway, Tony must have forgotten it, and now it was going crazy in the back seat, its red lights flashing on and off in random patterns. But were they, or just a little too fast for him to catch, making its simple series of sounds again and again and again? It was running by itself. No, no, I hit a pothole or something, that's all, jogged its switch, got it going. But he could see the small black switch on the side. It was pushed to off. But Merlin went on booping and beeping and buzzing. It reminded him of a Vegas slot machine paying off a big jackpot. The thing's plastic case began to smoke. The plastic itself was sinking, drooling, running like tallow. The lights flashed faster, faster. Suddenly they all went on at once, bright red, and the gadget emitted a strangled buzzing sound. The case cracked open. There was a brittle shower of plastic shards. The seat cover started to smolder underneath it. Ignoring his stomach, Leandro got up on his knees and knocked it on the floor. There was a charred spot on the seat where Merlin had lain. What is this? The answer irrelevant, nearly a scream. I would like to go home now, please. The ability to isolate a simple mathematical series. Did I think that? The John Leandro that flunked general math in high school? Do you mean it? Never mind that. Just bug out. No. He put the Dodge in gear and drove on again. He had gone less than 20 yards when he thought suddenly, with crazy exhilaration, the ability to isolate a simple mathematical series indicates the existence of a general case, doesn't it? You could express it this way, come to think of it. AX times 2 plus BXY equals CY times 2 plus DX plus EY plus F minus 0. Yep. It'll work as long as A, B, C, D, and F are constants. I think. Yeah. You bet. But you couldn't let A, B, or C be 0. That'd fuck it for sure. Let F take care of itself. Ha! Leandro felt like puking, but he still uttered a shrill, triumphant laugh. All at once he felt as if his brain had lifted off right through the top of his skull. Although he didn't know it, having pretty much dozed through that part of nerd math, he had reinvented the general quadratic equation in two variables, which can indeed be used to isolate components in a simple mathematical series. It blew his mind. A moment later, blood burst from his nose in an amazing flood. That was the end of John Leandro's first effort to get into Haven. He threw the gear shift into reverse and backed unsteadily up the road, weaving from side to side, right arm hooked over the front seat, blood pouring onto the shoulder of his shirt as he stared out through the back window with watering eyes. He backed up for almost a mile, then turned around in a driveway. He looked down at himself. His shirt was drenched with blood, but he felt better, a little better, he amended. Still, he didn't linger. He drove back to Troy Village and parked in front of the general store. He walked in, expecting the usual gathering of old men to stare at his bloody shirt with silent Yankee surprise. But only the shopkeeper was there, and he didn't look surprised at all. Not at the blood,
not at Leandro's question about any shirts he might have in stock.
"Look like your nose might have bled a tetch," the storekeeper said mildly,
and showed Leandro a selection of T-shirts. An inordinately large selection for such a small store as this, Leandro thought. He was slowly getting hold of himself, although his head still ached and his stomach still felt sour and unsteady. The flow of blood from his nose had scared him very badly.
"You could say that," Leandro said.
He allowed the old man to thumb through the shirts for him, because there was tacky blood still drying on his own hands. They were sized S, M, L, and XL. "Where the hell is Troy, Maine?" some said. On others there was a lobster and the slogan, "I got the best piece of tail I ever had in Troy, Maine." On others there was a large black fly which looked like a monster from outer space. "The Maine state bird," these proclaimed.
"You sure do have lots of shirts," Leandro said, pointing to a "Where the hell" in an M size.
He thought the lobster shirt was amusing, but thought his mother would be less than wild about the innuendo.
"Aye, yeah?"
the storekeeper said.
"Have to have a lot. Sell a lot."
"Tourists?" Leandro's mind was already racing ahead, trying to figure out what came next. He had thought he was onto something big. Now he believed it was one hell of a lot bigger than even he had believed.
"Some," the storekeeper said, "but there ain't been many down this way this summer. Mostly I sell them to folks like you."
"Like me?"
"I am. Folks with bloody noses."
Leandro gaped at the storekeeper.
"Their noses bleed. They wreck their shirts," the storekeeper said. "Same way you wrecked yours. They want a new one, and if they're just locals, like I expect you are, they ain't got no luggage and no changes. So they stop first place to come to and buy a new one. I don't blame 'em. Driving around in a shirt all over blood like yours would make me puke. Why, I've had ladies in here this summer, nice-looking ladies, too, dressed to the nines, who smelt like guts in a hog's head."
The storekeeper cackled, showing a mouth that was perfectly toothless. Leandro said slowly,
"Let me get this straight. Other people come back from Haven with bloody noses? It's not just me?" "Just you? Hell no! Shit a goddamn! The day they buried Ruth McCausland, I sold 15 shirts. That one day. I was thinking about retiring on the proceeds and moving to Florida."
The storekeeper cackled again.
"They was all out of towners."
He said this as if it explained everything. And perhaps in his mind it did.
"Couple of 'em was still spoutin' when they come in here. Noses like fountains. Ears, too, sometimes. Shit a goddamn."
"And nobody knows about this?" The old man looked at Leandro from wise eyes.
"You do, sonny," he said.
Chapter 6 Inside the Ship 1 "You ready, guard?" Gardner was sitting on the front porch, looking out at Route 9. The voice came from behind him, and it was easy, too easy for him not to flash on 100 sleazy prison movies, where the warden arrives to escort the condemned man along the last mile. Such scenes always beginning, of course, with the warden growling, "Are you ready, Rocky?" "Ready for this? You gotta be kidding." He got up, turned around, saw the equipment in Bobby's arms, then the little smile on Bobby's face. There was something knowing in that smile that he didn't like. "See something funny?" he asked.
"Heard it."
"Heard you, guard."
"You were thinking about old prison movies," Bobby said.
"And then you thought, ready for this? You gotta be kidding."
"I caught all of that one, and that's very rare."
"Unless you're deliberately sending." "That's why I was smiling." "You were peeking."
"Yes."
"Then it's getting easier to do," Bobby said, still smiling. From behind his decaying mental shield, Gardner thought, "I have a gun now, Bobby. It's under my bed. I got it in the First Reformed Church of the Tommyknockers. It was dangerous,
but it would be more dangerous not to know just how deep Bobby's ability to peek now went. Bobby's smile faltered a little.
"What was that one?" she asked.
"You tell me," he said. And when her smile began to change to a look of narrow suspicion, he added easily, "Come on, Bobby, I was just pulling your string a little. I was only wondering what you got there." Bobby brought the equipment over. There were two rubber snorkel mouthpieces attached to tanks and homemade regulators.
"We wear these," she said, "when we go inside."
Inside. Just the word lit a hot spark in his belly and triggered all sorts of conflicting emotions. Awe, terror, anticipation, curiosity, tension. Part of him felt like a superstitious native preparing to walk on taboo ground. The rest felt like a kid on Christmas morning. "The air inside is different, then," Gardner said. "Not so different." Bobby had put her makeup on indifferently this morning, perhaps having decided there was no longer any need to hide the accelerating physical changes from Gardner. Gard realized he could see Bobby's tongue moving inside her head as she spoke, only it didn't look precisely like a tongue anymore, and the pupils of Bobby's eyes looked bigger, but somehow uneven and wavering, as if they were peering up at him from underwater. Water with a slight greenish tinge. He felt his stomach turn over.
"Not so different," she said. "Just rotten."
"Rotten?"
"The ship's been sealed for over 25,000 centuries, Bobby said patiently. "Totally sealed. We'd be killed by the outrush of bad air as soon as we opened the hatch. So we wear these."
"What's in them?"
"Nothing but good old Haven air. The tanks are small. 40, maybe 50 minutes of air. You clip it to your belt like this, see?"
"Yes." Bobby offered him one of the rigs. Gard attached the tank to his belt. He had to raise his T-shirt to do it, and he was very glad he decided to leave the 45 under the bed for now.
"Start using the canned air just before I open it up," Bobby said. "Almost forgot. Here, just in case you forget."
She handed Gardner a pair of nose plugs. Gard stuffed them into a jeans pocket.
"Well," Bobby said briskly, "are you ready then? We're really going in there."
"We really are," Bobby said almost tenderly. Gardner laughed shakily. His hands and feet were cold.
"I'm pretty fucking excited," he said.
Bobby smiled.
"I am too.
Also, I'm scared." In that same tender voice, Bobby said,
"No need to be, Gard. Everything will be all right."
Something in that tone made Gardner feel more scared than ever. 2. They took the Tomcat and cruised silently through the dead woods, the only sound the minute hum of batteries. Neither of them talked. Bobby parked the Tomcat by the lean-to, and they stood for a moment looking at the silver dish rising out of the trench. The morning sun shone on it in a pure, widening wedge of light.
"Inside," Gardner thought again.
"Are you ready?" Bobby asked again.
"Come on, Rocky. Just one big jolt. You'll never feel a thing."
"Yeah, fine," Gardner said. His voice was a trifle hoarse. Bobby was looking at him inscrutably with her changing eyes, those floating, widening pupils. Gardner seemed to feel mental fingers fluttering over his thoughts, trying to pull them open.
"Going in there could kill you, you know," Bobby said at last.
"Not the air. We've got that licked." She smiled.
"It's funny, you know. 5 minutes on one of those mouthpieces would knock someone from the outside unconscious, and half an hour of it would kill him. But it'll keep us alive. Does that tickle you, Gard?"
"Yes," Gard said, looking at the ship and wondering the things he always wondered. "Where did you come from? And how long did you have to cruise the night to get here?"
"It tickles me. I think you'll be okay. But you know," Bobby shrugged, Your head, that steel plate, interacts somehow with the...
I know the risk.
As long as you do.
Bobby turned and walked toward the trench. Gardner stood where he was for a moment, watching her go.
I know the risk from the plate. What I'm less clear on is the risk from you, Bobby. Is it Haven air I'm going to get when I have to use that mask, or something like Raid?
But it didn't matter, did it?
He had thrown the dice, and nothing was going to keep him from seeing inside that ship, if he could. Not David Brown, not the whole world.
Bobby reached the trench. She turned and looked back, her made-up face a dull mask in the morning light, angling through the old pines and spruces which surrounded this place.
Coming?
Yeah, Gardner said, and walked over to the ship.
3.
Getting down proved to be unexpectedly tricky.
Ironically, getting up was the easy part. The button at the bottom was right there, in fact no more than the zero on a remote telephone handset. At the top, the button was a conventional electrical switch set on one of the posts which supported the lean-to. This was 50 feet from the edge of the trench.
For the first time, Gardner realized how all those car recalls could happen. Until now, neither of them had bothered with the fact that their arms were somewhat less than 50 feet long. They had been using the sling to go up and down for a long time now, long enough to take it for granted. Standing at the edge of the trench, they realized that they had never both gone down together. What both also realized, but neither said, was that they could have gone down one at a time. With someone to run the buttons at the bottom, all would have been well. Neither said it, because it was understood between them that this time, and only this time, they must go down together, perfectly together, both with one foot in the single stirrup, arms around each other's waists, like lovers in a descending swing. It was stupid. Just stupid. Just stupid enough to be the only right way. They looked at each other without saying a word, but two thoughts flew and crossed in the air. Here we are, a couple of college graduates. Bobby, where'd I leave my left-handed monkey wrench?
Bobby's strange new mouth quivered. She turned around and snorted. Gard felt a moment of the old warmth touch his heart then. It was the last time he really ever saw the old and unimproved Bobby Anderson.
Well, can you rig a portable unit to run the sling?
I can, but it's not worth taking the time.
I've got another idea.
Her eyes touched Gardner's face for a moment, thoughtful and calculating. It was a look Gardner could not quite interpret. Then Bobby walked away to the lean-to. Gardner followed her part way and saw Bobby swing open a large green metal box that had been mounted on a pole. She pawed through the tools and general junk inside, and then came back with a transistor radio. It was smaller than the ones his helpers had turned into new and improved satchel charges while Bobby was recuperating. Gard had never seen this particular radio before. It was very small.
One of them brought it out last night, he thought.
Bobby pulled up its stubby antenna, inserted a jack in its plastic case, and the plug in her ear. Gard was instantly reminded of Freeman Moss, moving the pumping equipment like an elephant trainer moving the big guys around the center ring.
This won't take long.
Bobby pointed the antenna back toward the farm. Gardner seemed to hear a heavy, powerful hum. Not on the air, but inside the air, somehow. For just a moment his mind muttered with music, and there was a headachy pain in the middle of his forehead, as if he had drunk too much cold water too fast.
Now what?
We wait, Bobby said, and repeated, it won't take long.
Her speculative gaze passed over Gardner's face again, and this time Gardner thought he understood that look. It's something she wants me to see, and this chance came up to show me. He sat down near the trench and discovered a very old pack of cigarettes in his breast pocket. Two were left. One was broken, the other bent, but whole. He lit it and smoked reflectively, not really sorry about this delay. It gave him a chance to go over his plans again. Of course,
If he dropped dead as soon as he went through that round hatch, it would put something of a crimp in those plans.
"Ah, here we go," Bobby said, getting up.
Guard also got up. He looked around, but at first saw nothing.
"Over there, Guard, the path."
Bobby spoke with the pride of a kid showing off her first soapbox racer. Gardner finally saw it and began to laugh. He didn't really want to laugh, but he couldn't help it. He kept thinking he was getting used to the brave new world of Haven's jury-rigged super-science, and then some odd new combination would tumble him right back down the rabbit hole. Like now. Bobby was smiling, but faintly, vaguely, as if Gardner's laughter meant nothing one way or the other.
"It does look a little strange, but it will do the trick. Take my word for it."
It was the Electrolux he had seen in the shed. It was not running on the ground, but just above it, its little white wheels turning. Its shadow ran placidly off to one side like a dachshund on a leash. From the back, where the vacuum hose attachments would have gone in a sane world, two filament-thin wires protruded in a V-shape.
"It's antenna," Gardner thought.
Now it landed, if you could call a touchdown from 3 inches a landing, and trundled over the beaten earth of the excavation area to the lean-to, leaving narrow tracks behind it. It stopped below the switch box, which controlled the sling.
"Watch this," Bobby said, in that same pleased, showing-off-my-soapbox-racer voice.
There was a click, a hum. Now a thin black rope began to rise out of the vacuum cleaner's side, like a rope rising out of a wicker basket in the Indian rope trick. Only it wasn't a rope, Gardner saw. It was a length of coaxial cable. It rose in the air, up, up, up. It touched the side of the switch box and slid around to the front. Gardner felt a crawl of revulsion. It was like watching something like a bat, a blind thing which had some sort of radar, a blind thing that could seek. The end of the cable found the buttons. The black one, which started the sling going down or up, the red one, which stopped it. The end of the cable touched the black one, and suddenly went rigid. The black button popped neatly in. The motor behind the lean-to started up, and the sling started to slip into the trench. The tension went out of the cable. It slipped down to the red stop button, stiffened, pushed it. When the motor had died, leaning over, Gardner could see the sling dangling against the side of the cut about 12 feet down. The cable rose and pushed the black button again. The motor started once more. The sling came back up. When it reached the top of the trench, the motor died automatically. Bobby turned to him. She was smiling, but her eyes were watchful.
"There," she said. "Works fine."
"It's incredible," Gardner said. His eyes had moved steadily back and forth between Bobby and the Electrolux as the cable ran the buttons. Bobby had not been gesturing with the radio, as Freeman Moss had with his walkie-talkie. But Gardner had seen the little frown of concentration, and the way her eyes had dropped just an instant before the coaxial cable slipped down from the black button to the red one. "It looks like a mechanical dachshund, something out of one of those terminally cute Kelly Freeze SF paintings. That's what it looks like. But it's not a robot, not really. It has no brain. Bobby's its brain. And she wants me to know it." And there had been a lot of those customized appliances in the shed, lined up against the wall. The one his mind kept trying to fix on was the washing machine with the boomerang antenna mounted on it. The shed. That raised a hell of an interesting question. Guard opened his mouth to ask it, then closed it again, trying at the same time to thicken the shield over his thoughts as much as he could. He felt like a man who has nearly strolled over the lip of a chasm 1,000 feet deep while looking at the pretty sunset. No one back home, at least that I know of, and the shed's padlocked on the outside. So just how did Fido, the vacuum cleaner, get out? He had really been only an instant from asking that question, when he realized Bobby hadn't mentioned where the Electrolux had come from. Guard could suddenly smell his own sweat, sour and evil.
He looked at Bobby and saw Bobby looking at him with that small, irritated smile that meant she knew Gardner was thinking, but not what.
"Where did that thing come from, anyway?" Gardner asked.
"Oh, it was around," Bobby waved her hand vaguely. "The important thing is that it works."
"So much for the unexpected delay. Want to get going?"
"Fine. I just hope that thing's batteries don't go flat while we're down there."
"I'm its battery," she said.
"As long as I'm all right, you'll get up again, guard."
"Okay?"
"Your insurance policy."
"Yes, I think I get it."
"Okay," he said. They went to the trench. Bobby rode the sling down first, while the cable rising from the side of the Electrolux ran the buttons. The sling came back up, and Gardner stepped into it, holding the rope as it began to go down again. He took a final look at the battered old Electrolux and thought again, how the hell did it get out? Then he was sliding into the dimness of the trench and the dank mineral smell of wet rocks, the smooth surface of the ship rising up and up on his left, like the side of a skyscraper without windows. 4. Guard stepped off the sling. He and Bobby stood shoulder to shoulder in front of the circular groove of the hatch, which had the shape of a large porthole. Gardner found it almost impossible to take his eyes from the symbol etched upon it. He found himself remembering something from earliest childhood. There had been an outbreak of diphtheria in the Portland suburb where he'd been raised. 2 kids had died, and the public health office had imposed a quarantine. He remembered walking to the library, his hands safely caught up in his mother's, and passing houses where signs had been stapled to the front doors, the same word in heavy black letters heading each. He asked her what it meant, and she said it meant there was sickness in the house. It was a good word, she said, because it warned people not to go in. If they did, she said, they might catch the disease and spread it.
"Are you ready?" Bobby asked, breaking in on his thoughts.
"What does that mean?" He pointed at the symbol on the hatch.
"Burma shave."
Bobby was unsmiling.
"Are you?"
"No. But I guess I'm as close as I'll ever get." He looked at the tank clipped to his belt and wondered again if he was going to draw some poison that would explode his lungs at the first breath. He didn't think so. This was supposed to be his reward. 1 visit inside the holy temple before he was erased, once and for all, from the equation.
"All right," Bobby said. "I'm going to open it."
"You're going to think it open," Gardner said, looking at the plug in Bobby's ear.
"Yes,"
Bobby replied dismissively, as if to say, "What else?"
"It's going to iris open. There'll be an explosive outrush of bad air, and when I say bad, I mean really bad."
"How are your hands?"
"What do you mean?"
"Cuts?"
"Nothing that isn't scabbed over."
He held his hands out like a little boy submitting to his mother's pre-dinner inspection.
"Okay."
Bobby took a pair of cotton work gloves from her back pocket and drew them on. To Guard's inquiring look, she said, "Hangnails on 2 fingers. It might not be enough, but it might." "When you see the hatch start to iris open, Guard, close your eyes. Breathe from the tank. If you whiff on what comes out of the ship, it's going to kill you as quick as a Drano cocktail."
"I," Gardner said, "am convinced."
He slipped the snorkel mouthpiece into his mouth and used the nose plugs. Bobby did the same. Gardner could hear, feel his pulse in his temples, moving very fast, like someone tapping rapidly on a muffled drum with 1 finger.
"This is it. This is finally it."
"Ready?" Bobby asked 1 last time. Muffled by the mouthpiece, it came out sounding like Elmer Fudd.
"Weddy?"
Gardner nodded.
"Remember?"
"Remember?"
Gardner nodded again.
"For Christ's sake, Bobby, let's go."
Bobby nodded.
"Okay, be ready."
Before he could ask her for what, that symbol suddenly broke apart in curves, and Gardner realized with a deep, almost sickening excitement that the hatch was opening. There was a high, thin, screaming sound, as if something rusted shut for a long time was now moving again, but with great reluctance. He saw Bobby turn the valve on the tank clipped to her belt. He did the same, then closed his eyes. A moment later, a soft wind pushed against his face, shoving his shaggy hair back from his brow. Gardner thought, "Death. That's death. Death rushing past me, filling this trench like chlorine gas. Every microbe on my skin is dying right now." His heart was pounding much too fast, and he had actually begun to wonder if the outrush of gas, like the rush of gas out of a coffin, his skittish mind chattered, wasn't killing him somehow after all, when he realized he had been holding his breath. He pulled a breath in through the mouthpiece. He waited to see if it would kill him. It didn't. It had a dry, stale taste, but it was perfectly breathable. 40, maybe 50 minutes of air. "Slow down, guard. Take it slow. Make it last. No panting." He slowed down. Tried, at least. Then that high, screaming noise quit. The outrush of air grew softer against his face. Then stopped entirely. Then Gardner spent an eternity in the dark, facing the open hatch with his eyes shut. The only sounds were the muffled drum of his heart and the sigh of air through the tank's demand regulator. His mouth already tasted of rubber, and his teeth were locked much too hard on the rubber pins inside the snorkel mouthpiece. He forced himself to get cool and ease up. At last, eternity ended. Bobby's clear thought filled his mind. "Okay. Should be okay. You can open those baby blues, guard." Like a kid at a surprise party, Jim Gardner did just that. 5. He was looking along a corridor. It was perfectly round, except for a flat ledge of walkway halfway up one side. The position looked all wrong. For a wild moment he visualized the Tommyknockers as grisly, intelligent flies crawling along that walkway with sticky feet. Then logic reasserted itself. The walkway was canted. Everything was canted, because the ship was at an angle. Soft light glowed out of the round, featureless walls. "No dead batteries here," Gardner thought. "These are really long-life jobbies." He looked into the corridor beyond the hatch with a deep and profound sense of wonder. It is alive, even after all these years. Still alive. "I'm going in, guard. Are you coming?"
"Gonna try, Bobby."
She stepped in, ducking her head so as not to bump it on the upper curve of the hatch. Gardner hesitated a moment, biting down on the rubber pins inside the mask again, and followed. 6. There was a moment of transcendent agony. He felt, rather than heard, radio transmissions fill his head, not just one. It was as if every radio broadcast in the world momentarily shrieked inside his brain. Then it was gone. Simply gone. He thought of the way that radio transmissions faded when you went into a tunnel. He had entered the ship, and all outside transmissions had been damped down to nothing. Nor was it only outside transmissions, he discovered a moment later. Bobby was looking at him, obviously sending a thought. "Are you all right?" was Gardner's best guess, but a guess was all it was. But he could no longer hear Bobby in his head at all. Curious, he sent back, "I am fine. Go on." Bobby's questioning expression didn't change. She was much better at this than Gardner, but she wasn't getting anything either. Guard gestured for her to go on. After a moment she nodded, and did. 7. They walked 20 paces up the corridor. Bobby moved with no hesitation, nor did she hesitate when they came to a round interior hatch set into the surface of the flat walkway on their left. This hatch, about 3 feet in diameter, was open. Without looking back at Gardner, Bobby climbed into it. Gardner paused, looking back along the softly lit corridor. The hatchway to the outside was back there, a round porthole giving onto the darkness of the trench. Then he followed. There was a ladder bolted to the new corridor, which was almost small enough in diameter to be called a tunnel. Guard and Bobby did not need the ladder. The ship's position had rendered the corridor almost horizontal. They went on their hands and knees, with the ladder sometimes scraping their backs. The ladder made Gardner uneasy. The rungs were spaced almost 4 feet apart. That was one thing. A man, even a very long-legged one, would have had difficulty using it. The other thing about the rungs was more unsettling. A pronounced semicircular dip, almost a notch, in the center of each. So the Tommyknockers had really bad fallen arches, he thought, listening to the rasp of his own respiration. Big deal, guard. But the picture that came to him was not of flat feet or fallen arches. The picture which stole into his mind, softly and yet with a simple, undeniable power, was of some not-quite-seen creature climbing that ladder, a creature with a single, thick claw on each foot, a claw which fit neatly into each of those dips as it climbed. Suddenly the round, dimly lit walls seemed to be pressing in on him, and he had to grapple with a terrible bout of claustrophobia. The Tommyknockers were here all right, and still alive. At any moment he might feel a thick, inhuman hand close about his ankle. Sweat ran into his eye, stinging. He whipped his head around, looking back over one shoulder. Nothing. Nothing, guard. Get yourself under control. But they were here. Perhaps dead, but somehow alive, just the same. In Bobby, for one thing. But you have to see, guard. Now go. He started crawling again. He was leaving faint, sweaty handprints on the metal, he saw. Human handprints inside this thing, which had come from God knew where. Bobby reached the mouth of the passage, turned on her stomach, and dropped out of sight. Guard followed, stopping at the mouth of the passageway to look out. Here was a large open space, hexagonal in shape, like a large chamber in a beehive. It was also canted at a crazy funhouse angle as a result of the crash. The walls glowed with soft, colorless light. A thick cable came out of a gasket on the floor. This split into half a dozen thinner cords, and each ended in a set of things which looked like headphones with bulging centers. Bobby wasn't looking at these. She was looking into the corner. Gardner followed her gaze and felt his stomach gain weight. His head swam dizzily. His heart faltered. They had been gathered around their telepathic steering wheel, or whatever the hell it was, when the ship hit. They had perhaps been trying to pull out of their dive to the very last. But it hadn't worked. And here they were, two or three of them at least, slung into a far corner. It was hard to tell what they looked like. They were too tangled together. The ship had hit, and they had been thrown to that end of this room. There they still lay. Interstellar car crash, Gardner thought sickly. Is that all there is, Alfie? Bobby did not go toward those brown husks piled in the lowest angle of this strange, bare room. She only stared, her hands clenching and unclenching. Gardner tried to understand what she was thinking and feeling and could not. He turned and carefully lowered himself over the edge of the passageway. He joined her, walking carefully on the canted floor. Bobby looked at him with her strange new eyes. What do I look like to her through those new eyes? Guard wondered. And then back toward the tangled remains in the corner. Her hands continued to open and snap closed. Gardner started toward them. Bobby clutched at his arm. Gardner shook her grip off without even thinking. He had to look at them. He felt like a child drawn toward an open grave, full of fear, but compelled to go on anyway. He had to see. Gardner, who had grown up in southern Maine, crossed what he believed to be, for all its starkness, the control room of an interstellar spacecraft. The floor under his feet looked as smooth as glass, but his sneakers held their grip easily. He heard no sound but his own harsh breathing, smelled only dusty haven air. He walked down the slanted floor to the bodies and looked at them. "These are the Tommyknockers," he thought. "Bobby and the others aren't going to look exactly like them when they're done becoming. Maybe because of the environment. Or maybe because the original physiological makeup of the, what would you call it, target group, results in a slightly different look each time this happens. But there's a kissin' cousin resemblance, all right. Maybe these aren't the originals, but they're close enough. Ugly fuckers." He felt awe, horror, and a revulsion that ran blood deep. "Late last night and the night before," a wavering voice sang in his mind, "Tommyknockers, Tommyknockers, knocking at the door." At first he thought there were five, but there were only four. One was in two pieces. None of them looked as if he, she, it had died easily or with any serenity. Their faces were ugly and long-snouted. Their eyes were filmed over to the whiteness of cataracts. Their lips were drawn back in uniform snarls. Their skins were scaly but transparent. He could see frozen muscles laid in crisscross patterns around jaws, temples, and necks. They had no teeth. 8. Bobby joined him. Guard saw awe on her face, but no revulsion. "These are her gods now, and one is rarely, if ever, revolted by one's own gods," Gardner thought. "These are her gods now. And why not? They made her what she is today." He pointed to each one of them in turn, deliberately, like an instructor. They were naked, and their wounds were clear. Interstellar car crash, yes. But he didn't believe there had been any mechanical failure. Those weird, scaly bodies were slashed, scored with ragged cuts. One six-fingered hand was still wrapped around the haft of something that looked like a knife with a circular blade. "Look at them, Bobby," he thought, even though he knew Bobby couldn't read him in here, even if he opened up all the way. He pointed here, to a grinning mouth buried in another creature's throat. There, to a wide wound gaping in a thick, inhuman chest. There, to a knife, still clutched in one hand. "Look at them, Bobby. You don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to see they were fighting. Having a good old knock-down drag-out here in the old control room. None of this, come, let us reason together shit for your gods." They were whipping some heavy numbers on each other. Maybe it started as an argument about whether or not to land here. Or maybe it was about whether or not they should have hooked a left at Alpha Centauri. Anyway, the results are the same. Remember how we always assumed a technologically advanced race of beings would be, if one ever made contact with us? We thought they'd be smart, like Mr. Wizard, and wise, like Robert Young on Father Knows Best. Well, here's the truth, Bobby. The ship crashed because they were having a fight. And where are the blasters, the phasers, the transporter room? I see one knife. The rest they must have done with mirrors, or their bare hands, or those big claws. Bobby looked away, frowning strenuously. A pupil who didn't want to learn the lesson, a pupil who was in fact determined not to learn it. She started to move off. Gardner caught her by the arm and pulled her back. Pointed at the feet. If Bruce Lee had had a foot like that, he would have killed 1,000 people a week, Bobby. The Tommyknocker's legs were grotesquely long. They made Gardner think of those guys who don stilts and Uncle Sam suits and march in 4th of July parades. The muscles below the semi-transparent skins were long, ropey, gray. The feet were narrow and not precisely toed. Instead, each foot sloped into that one thick, chitinous claw, like a bird's talon, something like a giant vulture's. Gardner thought of the dips in the ladder rungs. He shuddered. "Look, Bobby. See how dark the claws are? That's blood, or whatever they had inside them. It's on the claws because they did most of the damage." This place sure as shit didn't look like the bridge of the starship Enterprise before it crashed. Just before it hit, it probably looked more like a free-for-all cockfight out behind some redneck's barn. "This is progress, Bobby. Next to these guys, Ted the Power Man looks like Gandhi." Frowning, Bobby pulled away. "Leave me alone," her eyes said. "Bobby, can't you see?" Bobby turned away. She wasn't into seeing. Gardner stood by the desiccated bodies, watching her climb the deck like a woman climbing a steep, smooth hill. She didn't slip at all. She turned toward a far wall where there was another round opening and boosted herself in. For a moment, Gardner could see her legs and the dirty soles of her tennis shoes, and then she was gone. Gard walked up the slope and stood for a moment near the center of the room, looking at the single thick cord coming out of the floor, at the earphones that split off from it. The similarity to the setup in Bobby's shed was perfectly clear. Otherwise, he looked around. Hexagonal room, barren. No chairs, no pictures of Niagara Falls, or Cygnus B Falls, for that matter. No astrogation charts, no Mad Labs equipment. All the big-time science fiction producers and special effects men would have been disgusted by this emptiness, Gardner thought. Nothing but some earphones lying tangled on the floor, and the bodies, perfectly preserved but probably as light as autumn leaves by now. Earphones and remains like husks piled in that far corner where gravity had tossed them. Nothing very interesting about it. Nothing very smart. That fit. Because the Havenites were doing lots of stuff, but none of it was very smart when you got right down to where the short hairs grew. It wasn't disappointment he felt so much as stupid correctness. Not rightness. God knew there was nothing right about this, but correctness. As if part of him had always known it would be this way when and if they got in. No Disneyland razzmatazz. Only a dreary species of blankness. He found himself remembering W. H. Auden's poem about running away. Sooner or later you always ended up in one room under a naked light bulb, playing solitaire at 3 in the morning. Tomorrowland, it seemed, ended up being an empty place where people smart enough to capture the stars got mad and tore each other to shreds with the claws on their feet. So much for Robert Heinlein, Gard thought, and followed Bobby. 9. He trekked uphill, realizing he had entirely lost track of what his position was in relation to the world outside. It was easier not to think about it. He used the ladder to help himself along as he went. He came to a rectangular porthole and looked through it into something that might have been an engine room. Big metal blocks, square on one end, rounded on the other, marched off in a double row. Pipes, thick and dull silver in color, protruded from the square ends of these blocks and moved off at strange, crooked angles. Like straight pipes coming out of a kid's jalopy, Gard thought. He became aware of liquid warmth on the skin above his mouth. It divided in two and ran down his chin. His nose was bleeding again, slowly, but as if it meant to keep it up for a while. Is the light brighter in here now? He stopped and looked around. Yes. And could he hear a faint humming? Or was that imagination? He cocked his head. No, not imagination. Machinery. Something had started up. It didn't just start, and you know it. We started it up. We're kicking it over. He bit down hard on the mouthpiece. He wanted out of here. Wanted to get Bobby out. The ship was alive, In a weird way, he supposed it was the ultimate Tommyknocker. It was a howl. It was also the most horrible thing of all. Sentient creature. What? Woke it up, of course. Guard wanted it asleep. All of a sudden he felt too much like Jack, nosing around the castle while the giant slept. They had to get out. He began to crawl faster. Then a new thought struck him, stopping him dead.
What if it won't let you out?
He pushed the idea away and kept going. 10. The corridor branched into a Y, left arm continuing to angle up, the right turning steeply downward. He listened and heard Bobby crawling to the left. He moved that way and came to another hatch. She was standing below it. She glanced briefly up at Gardner with eyes that were wide and frightened. Then she looked back again. He got one leg over the lip of the hatch and paused. No way he was going in there. The room was lozenge-shaped. It was full of hammocks suspended in metal frames. There were hundreds of them. All were canted drunkenly upward and to the left. The room looked like a snapshot of a sailing ship's bunk room, taken just as the ship rolled in the trough of a swell. All the hammocks were full, their occupants strapped in. Transparent skins, dog-like snouts, milky, dead eyes. A cable ran from each scaled triangular head. Not just strapped, Gardner thought. Chained. They were the ship's drive, weren't they, Bobby? If this is the future, it's time to eat the gun. These are dead galley slaves. They were snarling. But Gardner saw that some of the snarls were half obliterated, because some of their heads seemed to have exploded, as if, when the ship crashed, there had been a gigantic backflow of energy that had literally blown their brains out. All dead. Strapped forever in their hammocks, heads lolling, snouts frozen in eternal snarls. All dead in this tilted room. Close by, another engine started up, chopping rustily at first, then smoothing out. A moment later, fans whirred into life. He supposed the newly started engine was driving them. Air blew against his face. Whether or not it was fresh was something he didn't intend to personally check on. Maybe opening the outer hatch started this stuff up, but I don't believe it. It was us. What starts up next, Bobby? Suppose they started up next. The Tommyknockers themselves. Suppose their grayish, transparent, six-fingered hands started to clench and unclench, as Bobby's hands had been doing as she stared at the corpses in the barren control room. What if those taloned feet began to twitch? Or suppose those heads began to turn and those milky eyes looked at them? I want out. The ghosts here are very lively, and I want out. He touched Bobby's shoulder. She jumped. Gardner glanced at his wrist, but there was no watch there, only a fading white shape on his otherwise tanned wrist. It had been a Timex, a tough old baby that had gone on a lot of tooths with him and come out alive. But 2 days of working on the excavation had killed it. There's one John Cameron Swayze never tried in those old TV ads, he thought. Bobby took the point. She pointed at the air bottle, clipped to her belt, and raised her eyebrows at Gardner. How long has it been? Gardner didn't know and didn't care. He wanted out before the whole damn ship woke up and did God knew what. He pointed back down the passageway. Long enough. Let's bug out. A thick, oily, chuckling noise began in the wall next to Gardner. He shrank from it. Drops of blood from his slowly bleeding nose splattered the wall. His heart was beating madly. Stop it. It's just some sort of pump. The oily noise began to smooth out, and then something went wrong. There was a screech of grinding metal, and a quick, thudding series of explosions. Gardner felt the wall vibrate, and for a moment the light seemed to flicker and dim. Could we find our way out of here in the dark if the lights went out? You make the joke, I think, senor. The pump tried to start again. There was a long, metallic scream, that set Gardner's teeth biting at the rubber plugs in his mouthpiece. It died away at last. There was a long, loud rattle, like a straw in an empty glass. Then nothing. Not everything lasted all that time with no damage, Gardner thought, and found this idea actually relieving. Bobby was pointing. Go, guard. Before he did, he saw Bobby pause and look back once at the ranks of hammocked dead. That frightened look was back on her face. Then guard was crawling back the way he came, trying to keep an even, steady pace as the claustrophobia wrapped itself around him. 11. In the control room, one of the walls had turned into a gigantic picture window 50 feet long and 20 feet high. Gardner stood gape-jawed, looking at the blue main sky and the fringe of pines and spruces and maples around the trench. In the lower right-hand corner, he could see the roof tree of their equipment lean-to. He stared at this for several seconds, long enough to see big white summer clouds drifting across the blue sky, before realizing it couldn't be a window. They were somewhere toward the middle of the ship, and deep in the ground as well. A window in that wall should show only more ship. Even if they had been near the hull, which they weren't, it would have given on a vista of mesh-covered rock wall, with maybe a squib of blue sky at the very top. It's a TV picture of some kind. Something like a TV picture, anyway. But there were no lines. The illusion was perfect. Forgetting, in this powerful new fascination, his claustrophobic need to get out, Gardner walked slowly toward the wall. The angle gave him a perverse sensation of flying. The effect was like slipping behind the controls of an airline trainer and pulling the mock controls up into a steep climb. The sky was so bright he had to squint. He kept looking for the wall, the way you might expect to see a movie screen through the picture as you got closer to it, but the wall just didn't seem to be there. The pines were a true clear green. Only the fact that he couldn't feel any breeze or smell the woods worked against the persuasive illusion. He walked closer, still looking for the wall. It's a camera. It's got to be, mounted on the outer rim of the ship. Maybe even the part Bobby stumbled over. The angle confirms that. But Jesus, it's so fucking real. If the people at Kodak or Polaroid saw this, they'd go out of their go. His arm was grabbed hard, and terror leaped up in him. He turned, expecting to see one of them, a grinning thing with a dog's head, holding a cable with a plug tip in one hand. Just bend down, Mr. Gardner. This won't hurt a bit. It was Bobby. She pointed to the wall, held out her hands and arms, and jittered them rapidly in some kind of charade, then pointed at the window wall again. After a moment, Gardner got it. In a grisly way, it was almost funny. Bobby had been miming electrocution, telling him that touching the window wall would probably be a lot like touching the third rail of a subway. Gardner nodded, then pointed toward the wider companionway through which they had entered. Bobby nodded back and led the way. As Gardner boosted himself up, he thought he heard a leaf-dry rattle and turned back, feeling a child's dreamy terror tug at his mind. He felt that it must be them, those corpses in the corner, them rising slowly to their taloned feet like zombies. But they still lay in their tangled drift of strange arms and legs. The wide, clear view of the sky and the trees on the wall, or through the wall, was dimming, losing reality and definition. Gardner turned away and crawled after Bobby as fast as he could. Chapter 7 The Scoop Continued 1 You're crazy, you know, John Leandro told himself as he pulled into exactly the same parking slot Everett Hillman had used not 3 weeks ago. Leandro did not, of course, know this. That was probably just as well. You're crazy, he told himself again. You bled like a stuck pig. There's two teeth less in your head,
and you're planning to go back there. You're crazy.
Right, he thought, getting out of the old car. I'm 24, unmarried, getting bulgy around the middle, and if I'm crazy, it's because I found this. I did. Me. I tripped over it. It's big, and it's mine. My story. No, use the other word. It's old-fashioned, but who gives a fuck? It's the right word. My scoop. I'm not going to let it kill me, but I'm going to ride it until it bucks me off.
Leandro stood in the parking lot at 1:15 on what was rapidly becoming the longest day of his life. It would also be the last, despite all his mental avowals to the contrary, and thought, good for you. Gonna ride it till it bucks you off. Probably Robert Capa, Ernie Pyle thought the same thing from time to time.
Sensible. Sarcastic, but sensible. That deeper part of his mind seemed to be beyond such sense, however.
My story, it returned stubbornly. My scoop. John Leandro, now clad in a T-shirt reading, Where the Hell is Troy, Maine? David Bright would probably have laughed himself into a hemorrhage over that one. Crossed the small parking lot of Maine Med Supplies, specializing in respiration supplies and respiration therapy since 1946, and went inside.
2.
$30 is a stiff deposit for an air mask, don't you think?
Leandro asked the clerk, thumbing through his cash.
He guessed he had the 30, but it was going to leave him with about $1.50. Wouldn't think they'd be a big black market item.
We never used to require one at all, the clerk said. And we still don't, if we know the individual or the organization, you know. But I lost one a couple of 3 weeks ago. Old man came in and told me he wanted some air. I figured he meant for diving, you know. He was old, but he looked tough enough for it. So I started telling him about Downey scuba dive in Bangor. But he said no, he was interested in ground portability. So I rented it to him. I never got it back. Brand new Bell flat pack. $200 piece of equipment.
Leandro looked at the clerk, almost sick with excitement. He felt like a man following arrows deeper and deeper into a frightening but fabulous and totally unexplored cavern.
You rented this mask? Personally?
Well, it was a flat pack, actually, but yes. My dad and I run the place. He was delivering oxy bottles down to Augusta. I caught hell from him. I don't know if he'll like me renting another Bell even, but with the deposit I guess it's okay.
Can you describe the man?
Mister, do you feel okay? You look a little white around the...
I'm fine. Can you describe the man who rented the flat pack?
Old, had a tan. He was mostly bald. He was skinny. Stringy, I guess you'd say. Like I say, he looked tough.
The clerk thought.
He was driving a Valiant.
Could you check the day he rented the flat pack?
You a cop?
Reporter, Bangor Daily News. Leandro showed the clerk his press card. Now the clerk also began to look excited.
He'd do something else? Besides rip off our flat pack, I mean?
Could you look up the name and date for me?
Sure.
The clerk flipped back through his rental book. He found the entry and turned the book so Leandro could read it. The date was July 26th. The name was scrawled but still legible. Everett Hillman.
You never reported the loss of the equipment to the police, Leandro said. It was not a question. If a complaint of theft had been lodged against the old geezer to compliment his landlady's understandable unhappiness at being stiffed for 2 weeks' rent, the cops might have taken more interest in how or why Hillman had disappeared, or where he had disappeared to.
No. Dad said not to bother. Our insurance doesn't cover the theft of rented equipment, see? And, well, that's why.
The clerk shrugged and smiled, but the shrug was slightly embarrassed, the smile slightly uneasy, and taken together they told Leandro a lot. He might be a terminal twerp, as David Bright feared, but he was not a stupid one. If they had reported the theft or disappearance of the flat pack, the insurance company wouldn't cover the loss. But this fellow's father knew some other way they could stick it to the insurance company. But for now, all that was very much a secondary consideration.
Well, thank you for all your help,
Leandro said, turning the book back around. Now, if we could finish up here?
Sure, of course.
The clerk was obviously happy to leave the subject of insurance behind.
And you won't put any of this in the paper until you check with my father, will you?
Absolutely not, Leandro said, with a warm sincerity that P.T. Barnum himself would have admired. Now, if I could just sign the agreement?
Right. I'll have to see some ID first, though. I didn't ask the old guy. I also heard from Dad about that, I can tell you. I just showed you my press card.
I know, but maybe I ought to see some real identification. Sighing, Leandro pushed his driver's license across the counter. 3. Slow down, Johnny, David Bright said. But Leandro was standing at an outdoor phone kiosk near the edge of a drive-in restaurant parking lot. He heard the beginnings of excitement in Bright's voice.
He believes me. Son of a bitch, I think he finally believes me.
As he had driven away from Maine Med Supplies and back toward Haven, Leandro's excitement and tension had grown until he thought he might explode if he didn't talk to someone else. And he had to. He recognized that as a responsibility that superseded his desire to get his scoop alone. He had to because he was going back, and something could easily happen to him. And if it did, he wanted to be sure somebody knew what he was on to. And Bright, as insufferable as he could be, was at least utterly honest. He wouldn't double-cross him.
Slow down. Yeah, I got to.
He switched the phone to his other ear. The afternoon sun was hot on his neck, but it didn't feel bad at all. He started with the ride to Haven, the incredible jam-up of stations on the radio, the violent nausea, the bloody nose, the lost teeth. He told him about his conversation with the old man in the general store, how empty the place had been, how the whole area could have been wearing a big sign that said, "Gone fishing." He didn't mention his mathematical insights because he could barely remember having them. Something had happened, but it was now all vague and diffuse in his mind. Instead, he told Bright that he had gotten the idea that the air in Haven had been poisoned somehow, that there had been a chemical spill or something, or maybe the escape of some natural but deadly gas from inside the earth. A gas that improves radio transmissions, Johnny? Yes, he knew it was unlikely. He knew all the pieces didn't fit yet, but he had been there, and he was sure it was the air that had made him sick. So he had decided to get some portable oxygen and go back. He related his coincidental discovery that Everett Hillman, whom Bright himself had dismissed as a nutty old man, had been there before him on exactly the same errand.
"So, what do you think?" Leandro said finally.
There was a momentary lag, and then Bright said what Leandro believed to be the sweetest words he had ever heard in his life. "I think you were right all the time, Johnny. Something very weird is happening out there, and I advise you very strongly to stay away." Leandro closed his eyes for a moment and leaned his head against the side of the telephone. He was smiling. It was a large and blissful smile.
Right. Right all the time. Ah, they were good words. Fine words. Words of balm and beatitude. Right all the time.
John? Johnny, are you still there?
Eyes still closed, still smiling, Leandro said, "I'm here. Just relishing it, David, old man, because I think I have been waiting my entire life for someone to tell me I was right all the time about something, about anything."
"Stay away. Call the state cops."
"Would you?"
"Fuck no." Leandro laughed.
"Well, there you go. I'll be okay. I've got oxygen."
"According to the guy at the medical supply place, Hillman did too. He's just as gone."
"I'm going," Leandro repeated. "Whatever's going on in Haven, I'm going to be the first one to see it and get pictures of it."
"I don't like it."
"What time is it?"
Leandro's own watch had stopped, which was funny. He was almost sure he'd wound it when he got up that morning.
"Almost 2.
"Okay, I'll call in by 4, again at 6, etc., until I'm home and dry.
If you or somebody there doesn't hear from me every 2 hours, call the cops.
Johnny, you sound like a kid playing with matches, telling his father if he catches on fire, Dad has permission to put him out.
You're not my father, Leandro said sharply.
Bright sighed. Look, Johnny, if it makes any difference, I'm sorry I called you fucking Jimmy Olsen. You were right. Isn't that enough? Stay out of Haven.
2 hours. I want 2 hours, David. I deserve 2 hours, goddammit.
Leandro hung up the phone.
He started back to his car, then turned and marched defiantly back to the walk-up window and ordered 2 cheeseburgers with everything on them. It was the first time in his life he had ever ordered food from one of those places his mother called roadside luncheonettes. Only when she said the word, she made such places sound like the blackest pits of horror, as in, it came from the roadside luncheonette, or Earth versus the microbe monsters. When they came, the cheeseburgers were hot and wrapped in grease-spotted sheets of wax paper with the marvelous words, Dairy Burger Ranch, printed all over them. He had gobbled the first even before he got back to his Dodge.
Wonderful, he said, the word muffled to something that sounded like wunnel.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Microbes, do your worst, he thought, with almost drunken defiance, as he pulled out onto Route 9. He was, of course, unaware that things were changing rapidly in Haven now, and had been ever since noon. The situation in Haven was, in nuclear parlance, critical. Haven had, in fact, become a separate country, and its borders were now policed. Not knowing this, Leandro drove on, tearing into his second cheeseburger, and regretting only that he hadn't ordered a vanilla shake to go with them.
4. By the time he passed the Troy General Store, his euphoria had dissipated, and his former low nervousness had returned. The sky overhead was a clear blue in which a few wispy white clouds floated, but his nerves felt as if there were a thunderstorm on the way. He glanced at the flat pack on the seat beside him, the gold cup covered with a round of cellophane, which read, Santa sealed for your protection. In other words, Leandro thought, microbes keep out. No cars on the road, no tractors in the fields, no boys walking barefoot along the side of the road with fishing rods. Troy dreamed silent, and Leandro guessed toothless, under the August sun. He kept the radio tuned to WZON, and as he passed the Baptist church, he began to lose the signal in a rising mutter of other voices. Not long after that, his cheeseburgers began to first walk around uneasily in his stomach, and then to jump up and down. He could imagine them squirting grease as they did so. He was very close to the place where he had pulled over on his first effort to get into Haven. He pulled over now without delay. He didn't want the symptoms to get any worse. Those cheeseburgers had been too damn good to lose.
5.
With the oxygen mask in place, the queasiness went away at once. That sense of low, gnawing nervousness did not. He caught a glimpse of himself, gold cup, bobbing on his mouth and nose, in the rearview mirror, and felt a moment of fright. Was that him? That man's eyes looked too serious, too intent. They looked like the eyes of a jet fighter pilot. Leandro didn't want people like David Bright to think he was a twerp, but he wasn't sure he wanted to look that serious.
Too late now. You're in it.
The radio babbled in 100 voices, maybe 1,000. Leandro turned it off. And there, up ahead, was the Haven town line. Leandro, who knew nothing at all about invisible nylon stockings, drove up to the town line marker, and then passed it into Haven, with no trouble at all. Although the battery situation in Haven was approaching the critical point again, force fields could have been set up along most of the roads leading into town. But in the frightened confusion over the developing events of the morning, Dick Allison and Newt had made one decision that came to directly affect John Leandro. They wanted Haven closed, but they didn't want anyone to strike an inexplicable barrier in the middle of what appeared to be thin air, turn around, and carry the tale back to the wrong people, which was everyone else on Earth just now.
I don't believe anyone could get that close, Newt said. He and Dick were in Dick's pickup truck, part of a procession of cars and trucks racing out to Bobby Anderson's place.
I used to think so, too, Dick replied. But that was before Hillman and Bobby's sister. No, someone could get in. But if they do, they'll never get out again.
All right, fine. You're queen for a day. Now can't you drive this fucker any faster?
The texture of both men's thoughts, of the thoughts all around them, was dismayed and furious. At that moment, the possible incursion of outsiders into Haven seemed the least of their worries.
"I knew we should have gotten rid of that goddamn drunk!" Dick cried out loud and slammed his fist down on the dashboard.
He was wearing no makeup today. His skin, as well as becoming increasingly transparent, had begun to roughen. The center of his face, and Newt's face, and the faces of all those who had spent time in Bobby's shed, had begun to swell, to grow decidedly snout-like.
6.
John Leandro, of course, knew nothing of this. He knew only that the air around him was poisonous, more poisonous than even he would have believed. He had slipped the gold cup down long enough to take a single shallow breath, and the world had immediately begun to fade into dimness. He put the cup back quickly, heart racing, hands cold. Some 200 yards past the town line marker, his Dodge simply died. Most Haven cars and trucks had been customized in such a way as to make them immune to the steadily increasing electromagnetic field thrown off by the ship in the earth over the last 2 months or so. Much of this work was done at Eltbarker's Shell, but Leandro's car had undergone no such treatment. He sat behind the wheel a moment, staring stupidly down at the red idiot lights. He threw the transmission into park and turned the key. The motor didn't crank. Hell, the solenoid didn't even click. Battery cable came off, maybe. It wasn't a battery cable. If it had been, the oil and amp lights wouldn't be glowing. But that was minor. Mostly he knew it wasn't his battery cable just because he knew it. There were trees along both sides of the road here. The sun, through their moving leaves, made dappled patterns on the asphalt and white dirt of the soft shoulders. Leandro suddenly felt that eyes were looking out at him from behind trees. This was silly, of course, but the idea was nonetheless very powerful.
Okay, now you have got to get out and see if you can walk out of the poison belt before your air runs out.
The odds get longer every second you sit here, giving yourself the creeps. He tried the ignition key once more. Still nothing. He got his camera, hooked the strap over his shoulder, and got out. He stood looking uneasily at the woods on the right side of the road. He thought he heard something behind him, a shuffling sound, and whirled quickly, lips pulled up in a dry grin of fear. Nothing. Nothing he could see. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. Get moving. You're just standing here, using up your air. He opened the door again, leaned in and got the gun out of the glove compartment. He loaded it, then tried to put it in his right front pocket. It was too big. He was afraid it would fall out and go off if he left it there. He pulled up his new T-shirt, stuck it in his belt, then pulled the shirt down over it. He looked at the woods again, then bitterly at the car. He could take pictures, he supposed, but what would they show? Nothing but a deserted country road. You could see those all over the state, even at the height of the summer tourist season. The pictures wouldn't convey the lack of wood sounds. The pictures would not show that the air had been poisoned.
There goes your scoop, Johnny. Oh, you'll write plenty of stories about it, and I've got a feeling you'll be telling a lot of network news filming crews which is your good side. But your picture on the cover of Newsweek, the Pulitzer Prize? Forget it.
Part of him, a more adult part, insisted that was dumb, that half a loaf was better than none, that most of the reporters in the world would kill to get just a slice from this loaf, whatever it turned out to be. But John Leandro was a man younger than his 24 years. When David Bright believed he had seen a generous helping of turp in Leandro, he hadn't been wrong. There were reasons, of course, but the reasons didn't change the fact. He felt like a rookie who gets a fat pitch during his first at-bat in the majors and hits an opposite-field triple. Not bad, but at his heart a voice cries out, "Hey, God, if you was going to give me a fat one,
Why didn't you let me get it all?
Haven Village was less than a mile away. He could walk it in 15 minutes. But then he would never get out of the poison belt before the air in the flat pack ran out, and he knew it. If only I'd rented two of these goddamn things. Even if you'd thought of it, you didn't have the cash enough to pay the frigging security deposit on two. The question is, Johnny, do you want to die for your scoop or not? He didn't. If his picture was going to be on the cover of Newsweek, he didn't want there to be a black border around it. He began to trudge back toward the Troy town line. He got 5 dozen steps before realizing he could hear engines. A lot of them. Very faint. Something going on over on the other side of town. Might as well be something happening on the dark side of the moon. Forget it. With another uneasy glance at the woods, he started walking again. Got another 12 steps, and realized he could hear another sound. A low, approaching hum from behind him. He turned. His jaw dropped. In Haven, most of July had been Municipal Gadget Month. As the becoming progressed, most Havenites had lost interest in such things. But the gadgets were still there. Strange white elephants, such as the ones Gardner had seen in Bobby's shed. Many had been pressed into service as border guards. Hazel McCready sat in her town hall office, before a bank of earphones, monitoring each briefly in turn. She was furious at being left behind to do this duty, while the future of everything hung in the balance out at Bobby's farm. But now, someone had entered town after all. Glad of the diversion, Hazel moved to take care of the intruder. 7. It was the Coke machine which had been in front of Cooter's Market. Leandro stood frozen with amazement, watching it approach. A jolly red-and-white rectangle, 6.5 feet high and 4 wide. It was slicing rapidly through the air toward him, its bottom about 18 inches over the road. I've fallen into an ad, Leandro thought. Some kind of weird ad. In a second or two, the door of that thing will open and O.J. Simpson is going to come flying out. It was a funny idea. Leandro started to laugh. Even as he was laughing, it occurred to him that here was the picture. Oh, God, here was the picture. Here was a Coca-Cola vending machine floating up a rural stretch of 2-lane blacktop. He grabbed for the Nikon. The Coke machine, humming to itself, banked around Leandro's stalled car and came on. It looked like a madman's hallucination, but the front of the machine proclaimed that, however much one might want to believe the contrary, this was the real thing. Still giggling, Leandro realized it wasn't stopping. It was, in fact, speeding up. And what was a soda machine, really? A refrigerator with ads on it. And refrigerators were heavy. The Coke machine, a red-and-white guided missile, slid through the air at Leandro. The wind made a tiny, hollow, hooting noise in the coin return. Leandro forgot the picture. He leapt to the left. The Coke machine struck his right shin and broke it. For a moment, his leg was nothing but a bolt of pure white pain. He screamed into the gold cup as he landed on his stomach at the side of the road, tearing his shirt open. The Nikon flew to the end of its strap and hit the gravelly soft shoulder with a crunch.
"Oh, you son of a bitch, that camera cost $400.
He got to his knees and turned around, shirt torn open, chest bleeding, legs screaming. The Coke machine banked back. It hung in the air for a moment, its front turning back and forth in small arcs that reminded Leandro of the sweeps of a radar dish. The sun flashed off its glass door. Leandro could see bottles of Coke and Fanta inside. Suddenly it pointed at him and accelerated toward him.
Found me! Christ!
He got up and tried to hop toward his car on his left foot. The soda machine bore down on him, coin return hooting dismally. Shrieking, Leandro threw himself forward and rolled. The Coke machine missed him by perhaps 4 inches. He landed in the road. Pain bellowed up his broken leg. Leandro screamed. The machine turned, paused, found him, and started back again. Leandro groped for the pistol in his belt and brought it out. He fired 4 times, balanced on his knees. Each bullet went home. The third shattered the machine's glass door. The last thing Leandro saw before the machine, which weighed just a bit over 600 pounds, hit him was various soft drinks foaming and dripping from the broken necks of the bottles his bullets had shattered. Broken bottlenecks coming at him at 40 miles an hour.
"Mama?"
Leandro's mind shrieked, and he threw his arms up in front of his face in a crisscross. He didn't have to worry about jagged bottlenecks after all, or the microbes, which might have been in the cheeseburgers from the burger ranch, for that matter. One of life's great truths is this. When one is about to be struck by a speeding 600-pound Coke machine, one need worry about nothing else. There was a thudding, crunching sound. The front of Leandro's skull shattered like a Ming vase, hurled onto the floor. A split second later, his spine snapped. For a moment, the machine carried him along, plastered to it like a very large bug, plastered to the windshield of a fast-moving car. His splayed legs dragged on the road, the white line unreeling between them. The heels of his loafers eroded to smoking rubber nodules. One fell off. Then he slid down the front of the vending machine and flopped onto the road. The Coke machine started back toward Haven Village. Its coin holder had been jarred when the machine hit Leandro, and as it moved rapidly through the air, humming, a steady stream of quarters, nickels, and dimes spewed out of the coin return and went rolling about on the road. Chapter 8. Guard and Bobby. 1. Gardner knew that Bobby would make her move soon. The old Bobby had fulfilled what the new and improved Bobby saw as its last obligation to good old Jim Gardner, who had come to save his friend, and who had stayed on to whitewash one hell of a strange fence. He thought, in fact, that it would be the sling, that Bobby would want to go up first, and once up, would simply not send it back down. There he'd be, down by the hatch, and there he'd die, next to that strange symbol. Bobby wouldn't even have to deal with the messy reality of murder. There would be no need to think about good old Guard dying slowly and miserably of starvation, either. Good old Guard would die of multiple hemorrhages very quickly. But Bobby insisted that Guard go up first, and the sardonic cut of her eyes told Gardner that Bobby knew exactly what he had been thinking, and she hadn't had to read his mind to do it, either. The sling rose in the air, and Gardner clung tightly to the cable, fighting a need to vomit. That need, he thought, was quickly going to become impossible to deny, but Bobby had sent him a thought which came through loud and clear as soon as they wriggled out through the hatch again. "Don't take the mask off until you get topside." Were Bobby's thoughts clearer, or was it his imagination? No, not imagination. They had both gotten another boost inside the ship. His nose was still bleeding, and his shirt was sopping with it. The air mask was filling up. It was by far the worst nosebleed he'd had since Bobby first brought him out here. "Why not?" he had sent back, trying to be very careful and send only that top thought, nothing below it. "Most of the machines we heard were air exchangers. Breathing what's in the trench now would do you in just as quick as breathing what was in the ship when we first opened it. The two won't equalize for the rest of the day, maybe longer." Not the sort of thinking one would usually suspect in a woman who wanted to kill you. But that look was still in Bobby's eyes, and the feel of it colored all of Bobby's thoughts. Hanging onto the cable for dear life, biting at the rubber pegs, Gardner fought to hold onto his stomach. The sling reached the top. He wandered away on legs that felt as if they were made of rubber bands and paper clips, barely seeing the Electrolux and the length of cable manipulating the buttons. "Count 10," he thought. "Count 10, get as far from the trench as you can, then take off the mask and take what comes. I think I'd rather die than feel like this anyway." He got as far as 5 and could hold back no longer. Crazy images danced before his eyes, dumping the drink down Patricia McCardle's dress, seeing Bobby reeling off her porch to greet him when he finally arrived. The big man with the gold cup over his mouth and nose, turning to look at him from the passenger window of a 4-wheel drive as Gardner lay drunk on the porch. "If I'd dug in a few different places out at that gravel pit, why, I just might have found that one too," he thought. And that was when his stomach finally rebelled. He tore the mouthpiece off and threw up, groping for a pine tree at the edge of the clearing and clinging to it for support. He did it again, and realized he had never experienced this sort of vomiting in his entire life. He had read about it, however. He was ejecting stuff, most of it bloody, in wads that flew like bullets. And bullets were almost what they were. He was having a seizure of projectile vomiting. This was not considered a sign of good health in medical circles. Gray veils drifted over his sight. His knees buckled. "Oh, fuck. I'm dying," he thought. But the idea seemed to have no emotional gradient. It was dreary news, no more, no less. He felt his hand slipping down the rough bark of the pine. He felt tarry sap. Faintly, he was aware that the air smelled foul and yellow and sulfuric. It was the way a paper mill smells after a week of still, overcast weather. He didn't care whether there were Elysian fields or just a big black nothing. There would not be that stink. So maybe he would come out a winner anyway. Best to just let go. To just... No. No, you will not just let go. You came back to save Bobby. And Bobby was maybe already beyond saving, but that kid's around, and he might not be. Please, guard, at least try. Don't let it be for nothing, he said in a cracked, wavering voice. Jesus Christ, please, don't let it be for nothing. The wavering gray mists cleared a little. The vomiting subsided. He raised a hand to his face and flung away a sheet of blood with it. A hand touched the back of his neck as he did, and Gardner's flesh pebbled with goosebumps. A hand. Bobby's hand. But not a human hand. Not anymore. Guard, are you all right? All right, he answered aloud, and managed to get to his feet. The world wavered, then came back into focus. The first thing he saw in it was Bobby. The look on Bobby's face was one of cold, cheerless calculation. He saw no love there, not even a counterfeit of concern. Bobby had become beyond such things. "Let's go," Gardner said hoarsely. "You drive, I'm feeling..." He stumbled and had to grab at Bobby's bunched, strained shoulder to keep from falling. "A little under the weather." 2. By the time they got back to the farm, Gardner was better. The bleeding from his nose had subsided to a trickle. He had swallowed a fair amount of blood while wearing the mouthpiece, and a lot of the blood he had seen in his vomit must have been that, he hoped. He had lost a total of 9 teeth. "I want to change my shirt," he told Bobby. Bobby nodded without much interest. "Come on out in the kitchen after you do," she said. "We have to talk." "Yes, I suppose we do." In the guest room, Gardner took off the T-shirt he had been wearing and put on a clean one. He let it hang down over his belt. He went to the foot of the bed, lifted the mattress, and got the .45. He tucked it into his pants. The T-shirt was too big. He had lost a lot of weight. The outline of the gun butt hardly showed at all if he sucked in his gut. He paused for a moment longer, wondering if he was ready for this. He supposed there was no way to tell such a thing in advance. A dull headache gnawed his temples, and the world seemed to move in and out of focus in slow, woozy cycles. His mouth hurt, and his nose felt stuffed with drying blood. This was it. As much a showdown as any Bobby had ever written in her westerns. High noon in central Maine. Make your play, pard. The ghost of a smile touched his lips. All of those two-for-a-penny sophomore philosophers said life was a strange proposition, but really, this was outrageous. He went out to the kitchen. Bobby was sitting at the kitchen table watching him. Strange, half-glimpsed green fluid circulated below the surface of her transparent face. Her eyes, larger, the pupils oddly misshapen, looked at Gardner somberly. On the table was a boombox radio. Dick Allison had brought it out to Bobby's 3 days ago, at her request. It was the one Hank Buck had used to send Pitts Barfield to that great repple-depple in the sky. It had taken Bobby less than 20 minutes to connect its circuitry to the toy photon pistol she was pointing at Gardner. On the table were two beers and a bottle of pills. Gardner recognized the bottle. Bobby must have gone into the bathroom and gotten it while he was changing his shirt. It was his Valium.
"Sit down, Gard," Bobby said.
3. Gardner had raised his mental shield as soon as he was out of the ship. The question now was how much of it still remained. He walked slowly across the room and sat at the table. He felt the 45 digging into his stomach and groin. He also felt it digging into his mind, lying heavy against whatever was left of that shield.
"Are those for me?" he asked, pointing at the pills.
"I thought we'd have a beer or two together," Bobby said evenly. "The way friends do? And you could take a few of those at a time while we talk. I thought it would be the kindest way."
"Kind," Gardner mused. He felt the first faint tug of anger. "Won't get fooled again," the song said. "But the habit must be awfully hard to break."
He himself had been fooled plenty. But then, he thought, maybe you're an exception to the rule, Gard, old Gard. I get the pills, and Peter got that weird sequarium in the shed. Bobby, your definition of kindness has undergone one fuck of a radical change since the days when you'd cry if Peter brought home a dead bird. Remember those days? We lived here together. We stood your sister off when she came, and never had to stick her in a shower stall to do it. We just kicked her ass the hell out.
He looked at her somberly. Remember, Bobby? That was when we were lovers as well as friends. I thought you might have forgotten. I would have died for you, kiddo. And I would have died without you. Remember? Remember us?
Bobby looked down at her hands. Did he see tears in those strange eyes? Probably all he saw was wishful thinking.
When were you in the shed?
Last night.
What did you touch?
I used to touch you, Gardner mused, and you me. And neither of us minded, remember?
What did you touch?
She screamed shrilly at him. And when she looked back up, he didn't see Bobby, but only a furious monster.
Nothing, Gardner said. I touched nothing. The contempt on his face must have been more convincing than any protest would have been, because Bobby settled back. She sipped delicately at her beer.
Doesn't matter. You couldn't have done anything out there anyway.
How could you do it to Peter?
That's how it keeps coming at me. The old man, I didn't know. And Anne barged in. But I knew Peter. He would have died for you, too.
How could you do it? God's name!
He kept me alive when you weren't here, Bobby said. There was just the faintest uneasy defensive note in her voice. When I was working around the clock. He was the only reason there was anything left for you to save when you got here.
You fucking vampire!
She looked at him, then away.
Jesus Christ, you did something like that, and I went along with it. Do you know how that hurts? I went along.
I saw what was happening to you. To a lesser degree, I saw what was happening to the others, but I still went along with it. Because I was crazy.
But of course you knew that, didn't you?
You used me the same way you used Peter. But I wasn't even as smart as an old beagle dog, I guess. Because you didn't even have to put me in the shed and stick one of those filthy, stinking, rotten cables in my head to do it. You just kept me oiled.
You handed me a shovel and said, "Here you go, Gard, let's dig this baby up and stop the Dallas police."
Except you're the Dallas police, and I went along with it.
"Drink your beer," Bobby said. Her face was cold again. "And if I don't?"
"Then I'm going to turn on this radio," Bobby said, "and open a hole in reality, and send you somewhere."
"To Altair 4? Gardner asked. He kept his voice casual and tightened his mental grip, shield, 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 on that barrier in his mind.
A slight frown creased Bobby's forehead again, and Gardner felt those mental fingers probing again, digging, trying to find out what he knew, how much, and how.
Distract her. Make her mad and distract her.
How?
You've been snooping a lot, haven't you? Bobby asked. Not until I realized how much you were lying to me, and suddenly knew. He had gotten it in the shed without even knowing it. Most of the lies you told to yourself, Guard.
Oh? What about the kid that died? Or the one that's blind?
How do you kn-
The shed. That's where you go to get smart, isn't it? She said nothing. You sent them to get batteries. You killed one and blinded the other to get batteries. Jesus, Bobby, how stupid could you get?
We're more intelligent than you could ever hope to—
Who's talking about intelligence? He cried furiously. I'm talking about smarts. Common fucking sense. The CMP power lines run right behind your house. Why didn't you tap them?
Sure, Bobby smiled with her weird mouth. A really intelligent, pardon me, smart idea. And the first time some tech at the Augusta substation saw the power drain on his dials—
You're running almost everything on C, D, and AA batteries, Guard said. That's a trickle. A guy using house current to run a big bandsaw would bang those needles harder.
She looked momentarily confused, seemed to listen, not to anyone else, but to her own interior voice.
Batteries run on direct current, Guard. AC power lines wouldn't do us any good.
He struck his temples with his fists and screamed,
Haven't you ever seen a goddamn DC converter? You can get them at Radio Shack for $3. Are you seriously trying to tell me you couldn't have made a simple DC converter when you can make your tractor fly and your typewriter run on telepathy? Are you—
Nobody thought of it!
She screamed suddenly. There was a moment of silence. She looked stunned, as if at the sound of her own voice.
Nobody thought of it, he said. Right. So you've sent those two kids, all ready to do or die for good old Haven. And now one of them is dead, and the other one's blind. It's shit, Bobby. I don't care who or what has taken you over. Part of you has to be inside someplace. Part of you has to realize that you people haven't been doing anything creative at all. Quite the opposite. You've been taking dumb pills and congratulating each other on how wonderful it all is. I was the crazy one. I kept telling myself it would be okay even after I knew better. But it's the same old shit it always was. You can disintegrate people. You can teleport them to someplace for safekeeping or burial or whatever. But you're as dumb as a baby with a loaded pistol.
I think you'd better shut up now, Guard.
You didn't think of it, he said softly. Jesus, Bobby. How can you even look at yourself in the mirror? Any of you?
I said, I think, idiot savant, you said once. It's worse. It's like watching a bunch of kids getting ready to blow up the world with soapbox derby plans. You guys aren't even evil. Dumb, but not evil.
Guard, you're just a bunch of dumbbells with screwdrivers. He laughed.
Shut up!
She shrieked.
Jesus, Guard said. Did I really think Sissy was dead?
Did I?
She was trembling. He nodded toward the photon gun.
So if I don't drink the beer and take the pills, you pack me off to Altair 4, right? I get to babysit David Brown until we both drop dead of asphyxiation or starvation or cosmic ray poisoning.
She was viciously cold now, and it hurt. More than he ever would have believed. But at least she wasn't trying to read him. In her anger, she had forgotten. The way they had forgotten how simple it was to plug a battery-driven tape recorder into a wall socket with a DC converter between the instrument and the power source.
There really isn't an Altair 4, just as there aren't really any Tommyknockers. There aren't any nouns for some things. They just are. Somebody pastes one name on those things in one place, somebody pastes on another someplace else. It's never a very good name, but it doesn't matter. You came back from New Hampshire talking and thinking about Tommyknockers, so here, that's what we are. We've been called other things in other places. Altair 4 has, too. It's just a place where things get stored. Usually not live things. Attics can be cold, dark places.
Is that where you're from? Your people?
Bobby,
or whatever this was that looked a bit like her, laughed almost gently. "We're not a people, guard. Not a race. Not a species. Klaatu is not going to appear and say, 'Take us to your leader.' No, we're not from Altair IV." She looked at him, still smiling faintly. She had recovered most of her equanimity, and seemed to have forgotten the pills for the time being. "If you know about Altair IV, I wonder if you've found the existence of the ship a little strange." Gardner only looked at her. "I don't suppose you've had time enough to wonder why a race with access to teleportation technology," Bobby wiggled the plastic gun slightly, "would even bother zipping around in a physical ship." Guard raised his eyebrows. No, he hadn't considered that. But now that Bobby brought it up, he remembered a college acquaintance once wondering aloud why Kirk, Spock, and company bothered with the Starship Enterprise when it would have been so much simpler to just beam around the universe. "More dumb pills," he said. "Not at all. It's like radio. There are wavelengths, but beyond that we don't understand it very well, which is true of us about most things, Guard. We're builders, not understanders. Anyway, we've isolated something like 90,000 clear wavelengths, that is, prolinear settings which do two things, avoid the binomial paradox that prevents the reintegration of living tissue and unfixed matter, and actually seem to go somewhere. But in almost all cases, it isn't anywhere anyone would want to go." "Like winning an all-expenses-paid trip to Utica, huh?" "Much worse. There's a place which seems to be very much like the surface of Jupiter. If you open a door on that place, the difference in pressure is so extreme it starts a tornado in the doorway which quickly assumes an extremely high electrical charge, which blows the door open wider and wider, like tearing a wound open. The gravity is so much higher that it starts sucking out the earth of the incursive world the way a corkscrew pulls a cork. If left on that particular station for long, it would cause a gravonic fault in the planet's orbit, assuming the mass was similar to Earth's. Or, depending on the planet's composition, it might just rip it to pieces." "Did anything like that come close to happening here?" Guard's lips were numb. Such a possibility made Chernobyl seem as important as a fart in a phone booth. "And you went along with it, Guard," his mind screamed at him. "You helped dig it up."
"No, although some people had to be dissuaded from doing too much tinkering along transmitter-transmatter lines." She smiled. "It happened somewhere else we visited, though."
"What happened?"
"They got the door shut before Shatter Day, but a lot of people cooked when the orbit changed." She sounded bored with the subject.
"All of them?" Gardner whispered.
"Nope. There are still 9 or 10,000 of them alive at one of the poles," Bobby said. "I think."
"Jesus. Oh, my Jesus, Bobby."
"There are other channels which open on rock. Just rock. The inside of some place. Most open in deep space. We've never been able to chart a single one of those locations using our star charts. Think of it, Guard. Every place has been a strange place to us. Even to us. And we are great sky travelers."
She leaned forward and sipped a little more beer. The toy pistol, which was no longer a toy, did not waver from Gardner's chest.
"So that's teleportation.
Some big deal, huh?
A few rocks, a lot of holes, one cosmic attic. Maybe someday someone will open a wavelength into the heart of a sun and flash-fry a whole planet."
Bobby laughed, as if this would be a particularly fine jest. The gun didn't waver from Guard's chest, however. Growing serious again, Bobby said, "But that's not all, Guard. When you turn on a radio, you think of tuning a station. But a band, megahertz, kilohertz, shortwave, whatever, isn't just stations. It's also all the blank space between stations. In fact, that's what some bands are mostly made up of. Do you follow?"
"Yes."
"This is my roundabout way of trying to convince you to take the pills.
I won't send you to the place you call Altair IV, guard. There I know you die slowly and unpleasantly. The way David Brown is dying?
I had nothing to do with that, she said quickly. It was his brother's doing entirely.
It's like Nuremberg, isn't it? Nothing was really anyone's fault.
You idiot, Bobby said. Don't you realize that sometimes that's the truth? Are you so gutless you can't accept the idea of random occurrence?
I can accept it. But I also believe in the ability of the individual to reverse irrational behavior, he said.
Really?
You never could. Shot your wife, he heard the booger-picking deputy say. Good fucking deal, huh?
Maybe sometimes people start the old atonement boogie a little late, he thought, looking down at his hands.
Bobby's eyes flicked sharply at his face. She had caught some of that. He tried to reinforce the shield, a tangled chain of disconnected thoughts like white noise.
What are you thinking about, guard?
Nothing I want you to know, he said, and smiled thinly. Think of it as, well, let's say, a padlock on a shed door. Her lips drew back from her teeth for a moment, then relaxed into that strange, gentle smile again.
It doesn't matter, she said. I might not understand, anyway. As I say, we've never been very good understanders. We are not a race of super-Einsteins. Thomas Edison in space would be closer, I think. Never mind.
I won't send you to a place where you'll die a slow, miserable death.
I still love you in my way, guard. And if I have to send you somewhere, I'll send you to... nowhere.
She shrugged.
It's probably like taking ether. But it might be painful.
Agony, even.
Either way, the devil you know is always better than the devil you don't.
Gardner suddenly burst into tears. Bobby, you could have saved me yay grief if you'd reminded me of that sooner.
Take the pills, guard. Deal with the devil you know. The way you are now, 200 milligrams of Valium will take you off very quickly. Don't make me mail you like a letter addressed to nowhere.
Tell me some more about the Tommyknockers, Gardner said, wiping at his face with his hands.
Bobby smiled. The pills, guard. If you start taking the pills, I'll tell you anything you want to know. If you don't...
She raised the photon pistol. Gardner unscrewed the top of the Valium bottle, shook out half a dozen of the blue pills with the heart shape in the middle. Valentines from the Valley of Torpor, he thought. Tossed them into his mouth, cracked the beer, and swallowed them. There went 60 milligrams down the old chute. He could have hidden one under his tongue, maybe, but six? Come on, folks, be real. Not much time now. I vomited my belly empty. I've lost a lot of blood. I haven't been taking this shit, and so have no tolerance to it. I'm some 30 pounds lighter than I was when I picked up the first mandatory prescription. If I don't get rid of this shit quick, they'll hit me like a... highballing semi.
Tell me about the Tommyknockers, he invited again. One hand dropped into his lap, below the table, and touched the butt.
Shield, shield, shield. Of the gun.
How long before the stuff started to work? 20 minutes?
He couldn't remember. And nobody had ever told him about ODing on Valium.
Bobby moved the gun a bit toward the pills. Take some more, guard. As Jacqueline Suzanne may have once said, six is not enough.
He shook out four more, but left them on the oilcloth.
You were scared shitless out there, weren't you? Gardner asked.
I saw the way you looked, Bobby. You looked like you thought they were all going to get up and walk.
Day of the Dead.
Bobby's new and improved eyes flickered, but her voice remained soft.
But we are walking and talking, guard. We are back.
Guard picked up the four Valiums, bounced them in his palm.
I want you to tell me just one thing, and then I'll take these.
Yes, just that one thing would in some fashion answer all the other questions, the ones he was never going to get a chance to ask. Maybe that was why he hadn't tried Bobby with the gun yet. Because this was what he really needed to know, this one thing.
I want to know what you are, Gardner said. Tell me what you are.
4.
I'll answer your question.
Or at least try to,
Bobby said. If you'll take those pills you're bouncing in your hand right now. Otherwise, you're going bye-bye, guard. There's something in your mind. I can't quite read it. It's like seeing a shape through gauze. But it makes me extremely nervous.
Gardner put the pills in his mouth and swallowed them.
More?
Gardner shook out another four and took them, all the way up to 140 milligrams now. Shooting the moon. Bobby seemed to relax.
I said Thomas Edison was closer than Albert Einstein.
And that's as good a way to put it as any, Bobby said.
There are things here in Haven that would have made Albert boggle, I suppose, but Einstein knew what E equals MC squared meant. He understood relativity. He knew things.
We
make things, fix things. We don't theorize, we build. We're handymen.
You improve things, Gardner said.
He swallowed.
When Valium took hold of him, his throat began to feel dry. He remembered that much. When it started to happen, he would have to act. He thought maybe he had already taken a lethal dose, and there were at least a dozen pills left in the bottle. Bobby had brightened a little.
Improve. That's right. That's what we do. The way we
improved Haven.
You saw the potential as soon as you got back.
No more having to suck the corporate tit. Eventually it's possible to convert totally to, organic storage battery sources.
They're renewable and long-lasting.
You're talking about people.
Not just people.
Although higher species do seem to produce longer-lasting power than the lower ones.
It may be a function of spirituality rather than intelligence. The Latin word for it, esse, is probably the best. But even Peter has lasted a remarkably long time, produced a great deal of power, and he's only a dog.
Maybe because of his spirit, Gardner said. Maybe because he loved you.
He took the pistol out of his belt. He held it, shield, against his inner left thigh.
That's beside the point, Bobby said, waving the subject of Peter's love or spirituality away.
You have decided, for some reason, that the morality of what we're doing is unacceptable. But then, the spectrum of what you think of as morally acceptable behavior is very narrow.
It doesn't matter. You'll be going to sleep soon.
We have no history, written or oral. When you say the ship crashed here because those in charge were, in effect, fighting over the steering wheel, I feel there's an element of truth in that. But I also feel that perhaps it was meant, fated, to happen. Telepaths are, at least to some degree, precognitives, guard, and precognitives are more apt to let themselves be guided by the currents, both large and small, that run through the universe. God is the name some people give those currents, but God's only a word, like Tommyknockers or Altair 4. What I mean is, we would almost certainly be long extinct if we hadn't trusted those currents, because we've always been short-tempered, ready to fight. But fight is too general a word. We...
Bobby's eyes suddenly glowed a deep, frightful green. Her lips spread in a toothless grin. Gardner's right hand clutched the gun with a sweaty palm.
We squabble, Bobby said. Le mot juste, guard.
Good for you, Gardner said, and swallowed. He heard a click. That dryness hadn't just sneaked up. All at once it was just there.
Yes, we squabble. We've always squabbled. Like kids, you could say,
Bobby smiled.
We're very childlike. That's our good side.
Is it now? A monstrous image suddenly filled Gardner's head. Grammar school kids heading off to school armed with books and Uzis and Smurf lunchboxes and M16s. And apples for the teachers they liked, and fragmentation grenades for those they didn't. And, oh, Christ, every one of the girls looked like Patricia McCardle, and every one of the boys looked like Ted the Power Man. Ted the Power Man, with greeny glowing eyes that explained the whole sorry fucking mess from Crusades and Crossbow to Reagan's missile-tipped satellites. We squabble. Every now and then we even tussle a bit.
We're grown-ups, I guess. But we still have bad tempers, like kids do, and we also still like to have fun, like kids do, so we satisfied both wants by building all these nifty nuclear slingshots. And every now and then we leave a few around for people to pick up, and do you know what? They always do. People like Ted, who are perfectly willing to kill, so no woman in Braintree with the wherewithal to buy one shall want for electricity to run her hairdryer. People like you, guard, who see only minimal drawbacks to the idea of killing for peace. It would be such a dull world without guns and squabbles, wouldn't it? Gardner realized he was getting sleepy.
Childlike, she repeated. We fight, but we can also be very generous, as we have here.
Yes, you've been very generous to Haven, Gardner said, and his jaws abruptly cracked open in a huge, tendon-stretching yawn. Bobby smiled.
Anyway, we might have crashed because it was crash time, according to those currents I mentioned. The ship wasn't hurt, of course, and when I started to uncover it, we came back.
Are there more of you out there? Bobby shrugged.
I don't know.
And don't care, the shrug said. We are here. There are improvements to be made. That is enough.
That's really all you are?
He wanted to make sure. Make sure there was no more to it. He was terribly afraid he was taking too long, much too long, but he had to know. That's all?
What do you mean, all?
Is it so little what we are?
Frankly, yes, Guard said. You see, I've been looking for the devil outside my life all my life because the one inside was so fucking hard to catch. It's hard to spend such a long time thinking you're Homer.
He yawned again, hugely. His eyelids had bricks on them. And discover you were Captain Ahab all the time. And finally, for the last time, with a kind of desperation, he asked her,
Is that all you are? Just people who fix things up?
I guess so, she said. I'm sorry it's such a letdown for you. Gardner lifted the pistol under the table, and at the same moment felt the drug finally betray him. The shield slipped. Bobby's eyes glowed. No, this time they glared. Her voice, a mental scream, blasted through Gardner's head like a meat cleaver. Gun! He's got a gun! He's got a... chopping through the rising fog. She tried to move. At the same time, she tried to bring the photon pistol to bear on him. Gardner aimed the .45 at Bobby under the table and pulled the trigger. There was only a dry click. The old slug had misfired.
Chapter 9. The Scoop. Concluded. 1. John Leandro died. The Scoop did not. David Bright had promised to give Leandro until 4, and that was a promise he intended to keep. Because it was honorable, of course, but also because he was not sure this was anything he wanted to stick his hand into. It might turn out to be a threshing machine instead of a new story. Nonetheless, he never doubted Johnny Leandro had been telling the truth, or his perception of it, crazed as his story sounded. Johnny was a twerp. Johnny sometimes didn't just jump to conclusions, but broad-jumped them completely. But he wasn't a liar. Even if he had been, Bright didn't believe he was smart enough to fabricate something this woolly. Around 2:30 that afternoon, Bright suddenly began to think of another Johnny. Poor, damned Johnny Smith, who had sometimes touched objects and gotten feelings about them. That had been crazy, too, but Bright had believed Johnny Smith, had believed in what Smith said he could do. It was impossible to look into the man's haunted eyes and not believe. Bright was not touching anything which belonged to John Leandro, but he could see his desk across the room, the hood pulled neatly over his word processor terminal, and he began to get a feeling, a very dismal one. He felt that Johnny Leandro might be dead. He called himself an old woman, but the feeling didn't go away. He thought of Leandro's voice, desperate and cracking with excitement. This is my story, and I'm not going to give it up just like that. Thought of Johnny Smith's dark eyes, his trick of constantly rubbing at the left side of his forehead.
Bright's eyes were drawn again and again to Leandro's hooded word cruncher. He held out until 3 o'clock. By then the feeling had become sickening assurance. Leandro was dead. There was just no maybe in it. He might not ever have another genuine premonition in his life, but he was having one now. Not crazy, not wounded, not one of the missing. Dead. Bright picked up the phone, and although the number he dialed had a Cleves Mills exchange, both Bobby and Guard would have known it was really long distance. 55 days after Bobby Anderson's stumble in the woods, someone was finally calling the Dallas police. 2. The man Bright talked to at the Cleves Mills State Police Barracks was Andy Torgerson. Bright had known him since college, and he could talk to him without feeling that he had the words "News Snoop" tattooed on his forehead in bright red letters. Torgerson listened patiently, saying little, as Bright told him everything, beginning with Leandro's assignment to the story of the missing cops. His nose bled, his teeth fell out, he got vomiting, and he was convinced that all of this was coming out of the air? Yes, Bright said. Also, this whatever it is in the air improved the shit out of his radio reception. Right. And you think he might be in a lot of trouble. Right again. I think he might be in a lot of trouble too, Dave. Sounds like he's gone Section 8. I know how it sounds. I just don't think that's the way it is. David, Torgerson said in a tone of great patience, it might be possible, at least in a movie, to take over a little town and poison it somehow. But there's a highway that runs through that little town. There's people in that little town, and phones. Do you think someone could poison a whole town, or shut it off from the outside world with no one the wiser? Old Derry Road isn't really a highway, Bright pointed out, not since they finished the stretch of I-95 between Bangor and Newport 30 years ago. Since then, the old Derry Road has been more like this big deserted landing strip with a yellow line running down the middle of it. You're not trying to tell me nobody's tried to use it lately, are you? No, I'm not trying to tell you much of anything. But Johnny did say he'd found some people who hadn't seen their relatives in Haven for a couple of months, and some people who tried to go in to check on them got sick and had to leave in a hurry. Most of them chalked it up to food poisoning or something. He also mentioned a store in Troy where this old crock is doing a booming business in T-shirts because people have been coming out of Haven with bloody noses, and that it's been going on for weeks.
Pipe dreams, Torgerson said. Looking across the barracks ready room, he saw the dispatcher sit up abruptly and switch the telephone he was holding to his left hand so he could write.
Something had happened somewhere, and from the goose look on the dispatcher's face, it wasn't a fender bender or purse snatching. Of course, people being what they were, something always did happen. And, as little as he liked to admit it, something might be happening in Haven as well. The whole thing sounded as mad as the tea party in Alice, but David had never impressed him as a member of the Fruits and Nuts Brigade, at least not a card-carrying one, he amended. Maybe they are, Bright was saying, but their essential pipe dreaminess can be proved or disproved by a quick trip out to Haven by one of your guys. He paused. I'm asking as a friend. I am not one of Johnny's biggest fans, but I'm worried about him. Torgerson was still looking into the dispatcher's office, where Smokey Dawson was now ratchet-jawing away a mile a minute. Smokey looked up, saw Torgerson looking, and held up one hand, all the fingers splayed. Wait, the gesture said. Something big.
I'll see that someone takes a ride out there before the end of the day, Torgerson said. I'll go myself if I can, but if I was to come over to Derry, could you pick me up?
I'll have to call you, Torgerson said. Something's happening here. Dawson looks like he's having a heart attack.
I'll be here, Bright said. I'm seriously worried, Andy.
I know, Torgerson said. There had not even been a flicker of interest from Bright when Torgerson mentioned something big was apparently up, and that wasn't like him at all.
I'll call you.
Dawson came out of the dispatcher's office. It was high summer, and except for Torgerson, who was catching, the entire complement of troopers on duty was out on the roads. The two of them had the barracks to themselves.
"Jesus, Andy," Dawson said.
I don't know what to make of this.
Of what? He felt the old tight excitement building in the center of his chest. Torgerson had his own intuitions from time to time, and they were accurate within the narrow band of his chosen profession. Something big, all right. Dawson looked as if someone had hit him with a brick. That old tight excitement. Most of him hated it, but part of him was a junkie for it. And now that part of him made a sudden, exhilarating connection. It was irrational, but it was also irrefutable. This had something to do with what Bright had just called about. Somebody get the Dormouse and the Mad Hatter, plop the Dormouse into the pot, he thought. I think the tea party's getting underway.
There's a forest fire in Haven, Dawson said. Must be a forest fire. Report says it's probably in Big Injun Woods.
Probably? What's this probably shit?
The report came from a fire watch station in China Lakes, Dawson said. They logged smoke over an hour ago. Around 2 o'clock. They called Derry Fire Alert and Ranger Station 3 in Newport. Engines were sent from Newport, Unity, China, Woolwich.
Troy, Albion, what about them? Christ, they bought of the town.
Troy and Albion didn't report.
Haven itself? The phones are dead.
Come on, Smokey, don't break my balls. Which phones?
All of them.
He looked at Torgerson and swallowed.
Of course, I haven't verified that for myself, but that isn't the nuttiest part. I mean, it's pretty crazy, but
go on and spell it. Dawson did. By the time he finished, Torgerson's mouth was dry. Ranger Station 3 was in charge of fire control in Penobscot County, at least as long as a fire in the woods didn't develop a really broad front. The first task was surveillance. The second was spotting. The third was locating. It sounded easy. It wasn't. In this case, the situation was even worse than usual because the fire had been reported from 20 miles away. Station 3 called for conventional fire engines because it was still technically possible that they might be of some use. They hadn't been able to reach anyone from Haven who could tell them one way or the other. As far as the fire wardens at 3 knew, the fire could be in Frank Spruce's east pasture or a mile into the woods. They also sent out 3 two-man crews of their own in four-wheel drive vehicles, armed with topographical maps and a spotter plane. Dawson had called them Big Injun Woods, but Chief Wawevoka was long gone, and today the new non-racist name on the topographical maps seemed more apt. Burning Woods. The Unity fire engines arrived first, unfortunately for them. 3 or 4 miles from the Haven Town line, with the growing pall of smoke still at least 8 miles distant, the men on the pumper began to feel ill. Not just one or two, the whole 7-man crew. The driver pressed on until he suddenly lost consciousness behind the wheel. The pumper ran off Unity's old schoolhouse road and crashed into the woods, still a mile and a half shy of Haven. 3 men were killed in the crash. 2 bled to death. The 2 survivors had literally crawled out of the area on hands and knees, puking as they went.
"They said it was like being gassed," Dawson said. "That was them on the phone?"
"Christ, no. The 2 still alive are on their way to Derry Home in an ambulance. That was Station 3. They're trying to get things together, but right now it looks like there's a hell of a lot more going on in Haven than a forest fire. But that's spreading out of control. The weather service says there's going to be an easterly wind by nightfall, and it don't seem like no one can get in there to put it out."
"What else do they know?"
"Jack shit!" Smokey Dawson exclaimed, as if personally offended.
"People who get close to Haven get sick. Closer you get, the sicker you are. That's all anyone knows, besides something's burning."
Not a single fire unit had gotten into Haven. Those from China and Woolwich had gotten closest. Torgerson went to the anemometer on the wall and thought he saw why. They'd been coming from upwind. If the air in and around Haven was poisoned, the wind was blowing it the other way.
Dear God! What if it's something radioactive?
If it was, it was like no kind of radiation Torgerson had ever heard of. The Woolwich units had reported 100% engine failure as they approached the Haven Town line. China had sent a pumper and a tanker. The pumper quit on them, but the tanker kept running and the driver had somehow managed to reverse it out of the danger zone with vomiting men stuffed into the cab, clinging to the bumpers and spread-eagled on top of the tank. Most had nosebleeds. A few ear bleeds,
One had a ruptured eye. All of them had lost teeth.
What kind of fucking radiation is that?
Dawson glanced into the dispatcher's booth and saw that all of his incoming lines were lighted.
Andy, the situation's still developing.
I know, Torgerson said. You gotta go talk to crazy people. I've gotta call the Attorney General's office in Augusta and talk to other crazy people. Jim Tierney's the best AG we've had in Maine since I put on this uniform.
And do you know where he is this gay day, Smokey?
No.
On vacation,
Torgerson said with a laugh that was slightly wild.
First one since he took the job.
The only man in the administration that might be able to understand this nuttiness is camping with his family in Utah. Fucking Utah.
Nice, huh?
Nice.
What the fuck's going on?
I don't know.
Any other casualties?
A forest ranger from Newport died, Dawson said reluctantly.
Who?
Henry Amberson.
What? Henry? Christ!
Torgerson felt as if he had been hit hard in the pit of his stomach. He had known Henry Amberson for 20 years. The two of them hadn't been best friends, nothing like it, but they had played some cribbage together when times were slow, done a little fly fishing. Their families had taken dinner together.
Henry, Jesus, Henry Amberson.
And Tierney was in fucking Utah.
Was he in one of the jeeps they sent out?
Yeah. He had a pacemaker, you know, and...
What?
What? Torgerson took a step toward Smokey, as if to shake him.
What?
The guy driving the jeep apparently radioed into 3 that it exploded in Amberson's chest.
Oh, my Jesus Christ.
It's not sure yet, Dawson said quickly. Nothing is. The situation is still developing.
How could a pacemaker explode?
Torgerson asked softly.
I don't know.
It's a joke, Torgerson said flatly. Either some weird joke, or something like that radio show that time, War of the Worlds. Timidly, Smokey said,
I don't think it's a joke.
Or a hoax.
Neither do I, Torgerson said.
He headed for his office and the telephone.
Fucking Utah, he said softly.
And then left Smokey Dawson to try to keep up with the increasingly unbelievable information that was coming in from the area of which Bobby Anderson's farm was the center.
3.
Torgerson would have called the AG's office first if Jim Tierney hadn't been in fucking Utah. Since he was, he put it off long enough to make a quick call to David Bright at the Bangor Daily News.
David, it's Andy. Listen,
We've got reports there's a fire in Haven, Andy. Maybe a big one. Have you got that?
Yeah, we do. David, I can't take you over there. The information you gave me checks out, though. Fire crews and recon people can't get into town. They get sick. We've lost a forest ranger. A guy I knew. I heard...
He shook his head.
Forget what I heard. It's too goddamn crazy to be true.
Bright's voice was excited.
What was it?
Forget it.
But you say firemen and rescue crews are getting sick?
Recon people. We don't know yet if anyone needs rescuing or not. Then there's the shit about the fire trucks and jeeps. Vehicles seem to stop running when they get close to or into Haven.
What? You heard me.
You mean it's like the pulse?
Pulse? What pulse?
He had a crazy idea that Bright was talking about Henry's pacemaker, that he had known all along.
It's a phenomenon that's supposed to follow big nuclear bangs. Cars stop dead.
Christ.
What about radios?
Them, too.
But your friends said...
All over the band, yes, hundreds.
Can I at least quote you on the sick firemen and rescue people, the vehicle stopping?
Yeah.
As Mr. Source, Mr. Informed Source...
When did you first hear...
I don't have time to do the Playboy interview, David. Your Leandro went to Maine Med Supplies for air?
Yes.
He thought it was the air,
Torgerson said, more to himself than to Bright.
That's what he thought. Andy, you know what else stops cars dead, according to reports we get from time to time?
What?
UFOs.
Don't laugh. It's true.
People who sight flying saucers at close range, when they're in their cars or planes, almost always say their motors just drop dead until the thing goes away.
He paused. Remember the doctor who crashed his plane in Newport a week or two ago?
War of the Worlds, Torgerson thought again. What a pile of crap.
But Henry Amberson's pacemaker had... what? Exploded? Could that possibly be true?
He would make it his business to find out. That you could take to the bank. I'll be talking to you, Davy, Torgerson said, and hung up.
It was 3:15. In Haven, the fire which had begun at the old Frank Garrick farm had been burning for over an hour, and was now spreading toward the ship in a widening crescent. 4. Torgerson called Augusta at 3:17 p.m. At that time, two sedans with a total of 6 investigators in them were already northbound on I-95. Fire Station 3 had called the AG's office at 2:26 p.m. and the Derry State Police Barracks at 2:49.